which came initially this night. So you're as tired as I am. You shouldn't be here. But let's plow through. We keep chopping and changing the program because Parliament's program is changing, and I do apologize for that, particularly because we've got so many responsibilities we have to fulfill as a committee. I think we, by far, the committee with most pieces of legislation at the moment. I think it's probably 6 or 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6, and we're still processing the one. Now, just to say to you, we still await one piece of legislation, the waste one. It's still not been certified, so I'm not sure how we're going to process that. Our time's basically run out. Now, today we will be spending on 3 inputs. First, we just have a short briefing on the new bill that's been introduced by Water, which is the Water Research Amendment Bill. Obviously, I have called for submissions and the date for those to be, the final date is the 30th of September. So until the end of this month, people have a chance to respond to that. So we're just taking a short briefing now that we know what the bill is about. We'll take another briefing when we do possible public hearings. Then we're going to hear, remember there was a cut-off date for submissions of the SAWS bill. We only received one submission. The cut-off date was 1 or 2 weeks ago. We've only received one submission from Agri. They say, did we hand it out to members? Bring copies, please. I haven't looked at it, but we will. I've asked the department to look at the submission in any case to tell us if there's something in it. They are not interested in making an oral submission, so at least there's one submission there. And mainly today, all I want to do is really look at the bill we passed as a committee last time. We reached a stage when we passed the bill and then it was withdrawn. Just to see what the differences are between the bill that we all agreed to and the one that's been introduced now, and see if there are changes and so on. And then we'll also start processing that. And then thirdly, if there's time left, we will continue with the processing of the ICM. Remember, we were about halfway through the bill, the processing. So we will continue with that processing. Then tomorrow, we're doing the joint briefing between our department and Minerals and Water on this mining stuff. Remember, there's that whole complicated thing. So we're having that joint sitting tomorrow. See how we can deal with that. Then next week, the first 2 days, remember next week's a committee week, so we have the whole day. The first 2 days are set aside for public hearings. Chileka, the deadline is this Friday, coming Friday. And so there aren't many submissions. I think there's one submission on air quality and one on national environment. And we haven't received the waste one, so that we can't deal with. So once the cutoff is by Friday, we'll clearly, if there are people that want to give, I think you must, the submissions that have come already, you must phone them and see if they want to come and make oral submissions so that we can see. If we do, we'll try and do that on the Tuesday. And if there's no other space for that, we'll then continue with other bills that we're processing, like the ICM. And if we finish on those, then we finish and we can't use the rest of the time. I thought there were going to be a lot of submissions, but there's time ready. And then the Thursday is the, in the morning we're receiving the briefing. briefing on the National Water Research Strategy 2, which Cabinet adopted, and we had public hearings on it, just to see what they've done. And then also the new policy review that that department has done has been finished. So we're going to see what policy initiatives they want to do for the next management. And then in the afternoon, we'll take the state of reports from here. Remember, there are 5 states. See what the rivers and the biodiversity and what the state of that is. So that's a full program for next week. And then there's a recess. And then when we come back, we're going to do the PRR. One day. That's it. And then the rest of the term, we'll be doing the processes. The BRR is the annual report of the department, and we then relook everything we relooked on the budget in March. We have to like relook, and that's why I'm just taking one day, because we've done it already. We've done reports and stuff. And then the rest of the time we'll see if we fit in. I'm still trying to get the week that Parliament adjourns, that weekend and a few days in the next week, for us to do the workshop on the rhinos. I've been given a date by the department that Kruger is available at the end of November, but the problem, once we leave here on the 7th, to try and get people back from and get permission from parties to release them to come back to Parliament is very small. So I'm trying to do it in that same, when we leave here, to do it in that period. Otherwise, I don't understand. So I'm waiting for a return from the department to see if they can get those earlier dates. And then we'll make the application. We also have, where is it, on the 25th of September, we've been given permission to be part of this symposium of the Water Research Council Commission on the 25th to the 27th of September. Now, what I've committed us to is, will people approve both to stay on if they want to stay on, one or two from this point. So we have a stakeholder engagement, which I'm still waiting for Mr. Naidoo to fully brief me on what exactly we're going to do there. And then that is on the 25th, the afternoon of the 25th of September in Pretoria. We're having a engagement with stakeholders around water issues and water research issues and so on. We can see how we want to mold that. I imagine it's the type of difficulties we've raised here. We will try and engage also with the stakeholders to have a nice tete-a-tete way how we see the water issue now that we're at the end of our term and what we look at and where we think the future will go. So that'll be a little nice concern. Mr. Naidoo and them have considered to make us part of that process, which is a sort of very nice thought. That's why I try to make sure we could go there. And then in the evening, there is a dinner where the Minister of Science will speak, and I'll also make this small input. Then, if I've also got permission for people to stay on for the symposium if they want to, at least one or two from the majority party and one or two from the opposition. So please let us know if you're interested to stay for the rest of the symposium. I won't be able to probably make that. I've not finally decided, but I don't think I'll be able to make it. But we need to see if there are people that are interested to participate in the rest of the symposium. We have got permission for that. So that is basically the program for now. You can see it's quite a full program. And a lot of it depends on how we move with pieces of legislation. When they're ready, then we can go on with them and so on. All right. Anyone want to say anything on the program? Is there anything there? I think. So just sort out, let's finalize who wants to go to the, and then get us a copy of the Bill, we're starting this morning just for a first brief briefing. Is the Water Research Amendment. I have an apology from the DG who's on his way to the plane. But we may have Mr. Singh here who can give us the briefing so long. Now, I also engaged with Mr. Naidu of the Water Research Commission that I thought we needed the, you know, they've just gone through a whole institutional review process. I don't know if any of you were interviewed by, there's a panel that they had. I know I had to withdraw from the well, they called me at the end of the interview and I had a few views, the kind of views we've expressed. Basically that we think the institution does good work, but what we don't see is the link between the work they do and how that benefits government. We're sure that there is benefit, but we don't see the link and that they must create systems to make sure that that link's not showing. That kind of thing and a few other little things that they felt. But on the whole, so I was hoping that we could get that institutional review as we're now doing a bill, you know, amendment bill around this, but unfortunately that review has not been processed properly through the department yet, so we are on hold. So hopefully before we finalize the bill, we will be able to have that institutional review. So I do hope that this thing is processed through the department quickly. This is very important because I know what's going to happen. We're going to do a poll here and then there's going to be things that are outstanding because, and I think that's not a good way of legislating. All right, so that's basically the story. Mr. Singh, over to you. There is a input and the bill is hopefully with you. Yeah, you can sit down.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Thank you for giving us the opportunity. Let me introduce myself. I'm Anil Singh. I'm the Head of Legal Services. I'm supported today by Vincent Boneni and my colleague Joseph Darby and the CE of the Water Research Commission. Mr. Naidu is here to support us, and we also have support from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, Mr. Malusi, who's sitting behind me. Mr. Chair, thank you for accommodating the bill in a very, very busy program, and thank you for the indulgence in that regard. I'm not going to go through, as you said, we have a time constraint, so I'm going to go a very high level and speak to some of the critical issues that this bill does seek to address. And I want to concur with your sentiment that, in fact, the strategic review of the water research institution is important and we should not be trying to do it in a piecemeal approach. We need to take cognizance of what that outcomes are and how, what impact it has on the bill. The objective of the bill is basically reforming and strengthening South Africa's water research landscape. The water research strategy was the framework for water research in South Africa and guided by, amongst others, the priorities, government program of action, priorities related to water-related SIPs, accelerate the attainment of the goals of Millennium Development, some of them, global change in the green economy drives, South Africa's future water security initiatives, and the thrust is to deal with the forthcoming hydrological hazards in terms of fracking, etc., generation of knowledge and skills required to understand the biospherical environment and hydrological cycle in its entirety. So it's part of the whole water value chain. So in a sense, the bill is looking to take the water research institution to a higher trajectory to see how it can actually contribute towards the goals of poverty reduction, economic development, etc., etc. So, where am I? Yeah. then specifically dealing with the pearl, it's a very old act. We're dealing with the 1971 act. In fact, when we were asked the other day to get a word version of this bill, we were told that the word version is not possible because it was back in 1971 when they used typewriters. So we have to retype a word version of the 1971 bill. But just by the way, so the specific provisions are dealing with the appointment of the members of the board and the CE in line with all our entities' legislation. And essentially we are changing the commission into a board or a council. The commissions, as we now know it, exists as Chapter 9 entities, so it can't remain a commission. There is also the document called the Presidential Review Recommendations on State-Owned Enterprises, and to an extent then there's an alignment with that process, with that provision. But other provisions are basically, when we do these bills, we do it in a thematic way, and we do the different themes of alignment, different themes of basically textual improvements, etc., which I'll get to. So we're looking at the PFMA. In the PFMA, the main issue is the management of the research fund and the levies. The National Water Act devolves water management to catchment level. The Water Services Act is our regulatory regime. We've spoken, Mr. Chair, about going the route of the One Act solution in terms of having an expanded National Water Act. And the other legislation is the NEMA. There's a whole plethora of legislation. I'm not going to get to all of those ones, but you can see what we are trying to do in terms of getting this bill in line with that, all those particular legislation. And then also widen the scope for the Water Research Council in future to collaborate with other institutions dealing with water-related research, the CSIR, the Agricultural Research Council, UNESCO, etc. The proposed changes is basically we are amending certain sections, Section 3, to include a removal of the reference to specific institutions such as the CSIR, and then we are opening up the opportunity for the WRC to work with a wider range of institutions than what was envisaged in 1971. Proposed amendments to Section 4 regarding the board, the functioning of the board, to bring the functioning of the board in line with contemporary corporate governance best practices and the prescripts of the PFMA, and then the process of appointing the board members is the fundamental issue there. In this next section, we deal with...
We have strong views on this board story. I hope you can come and justify what you have to do with this. And that you make sure that in line with the constitutional principle that policy is made by the executive, that it's captured in this, in your bills. Because both departments are not doing it. So I hope you guys have done it properly, otherwise you're going to get an uphill battle from us.
Yeah, I note that point, Mr. Chair. The issue relates the next one is the issues relating to governance, membership of the board. The Act currently provides that the DG of the Department of Water Affairs is an ex officio member of the board. This position was facing a potential conflict of interest in that the DG is the accounting officer of the department and sitting on the board and being responsible for the department in the department's role as oversight and regulation of the institution. The recommendation, therefore, is to remove the Director General as a member of the board. And that is basically to deal with the conflict in that provision. Then the other section deals with the functioning of the board. We have to have a code of conduct, board charter, all of those tools, so we call them, for best practice around how boards are managed. the issue of declaration of interest, the issue of dealing with declaring what members' interests are and whether there's a conflict on if they fit in that capacity. Then basically the sections are aligned with the relevant sections of the National Water Act. And Mr. Chair, the recommendation is that the departments, the minister, goes through the process to nominate, to get the boards nominated, etc., and then makes that proposal to cabinet for cabinet ratification or cabinet approval. And that's what's also in the Presidential Review Committee for State-Owned Enterprises. So that's basically the best practice at the current stage. Then also to bring the board also in terms of the auditing, the audit committee, etc., is essential that we deal with enhancing the corporate governance elements of how the board operates. Then Section 10 deals with the issues of the CE, the staff of the WRC, and the conditions of employment. The CE is already now, we refer to Mr. Naidu as a CE, but the Act is regarded as the Executive Director. It's to clarify the appointment process of the CE and the staff, and the proposed appointment process, the Minister appoints the CE on recommendation from the Board for a period of not more than 5 years, with a possible reappointment for a second term. The proposed amendments also mean the termination of the employment of the CE will be done by the Minister after consultation with the Board. This section is dealing with the pricing strategy and the need to align Section 11 with the National Water Act pricing strategy and the institutional arrangements. Then is to ensure the determining of the charges or tariffs and the collection of the charges is done in accordance with the requirements of the National Water Act. The intention is to limit the financial risk to the WRC of poor billing or less than optimal billing and under collection by either DWA or the CMAs in future when the billing function is transferred to them. The amendment should also ensure that the DWA or the CMAs carry any risk associated with under billing, incorrect billing, or the failure to collect billing revenue. The under recovery, the DWA options opts to pay the WRC before allocating money to DWA requirements, ensuring that the WRC receives its budget. So in other words, the uncertainty around the under-collection is basically ameliorated by the department through an agreement in terms of which the department will pay over the percentage to the WRC. Basically, it gives them certainty in terms of operating, in terms of salaries, in terms of their associated costs, running costs, etc. The payment by the CMAs may put this at risk unless appropriate contractual arrangements are in place, and that we are busy with those contractual arrangements. Then Section 13 deals with water research may use its funding of not more than 10% of total allocation outside of South Africa for research purposes. There's a rationale in that the resources must be basically looking focused inward so that the country can benefit from it. And obviously there is opportunity for partnership with UNESCO centers, etc., and that is there. But the allocation itself, we are saying should be basically directed and addressing the needs of the developing state. Investment options and alignment with the PFFA, these are some of the other aspects. The reporting, Section 14 deals with the reporting and auditing requirements, which we will obviously bring in line with the PFMA. I think, Mr. Chair, that brings us to the end of the presentation. As I indicated, we're not going to go, we are going to get the opportunity to line by line, but this is just a high level snippets of some of the major sections that are being amended or proposed, and it is submitted humbly for your consideration. I'm going to stop there in the interest of time and then be guided by yourself, Honorable Chair, on the way forward.
Thank you. You refer to the presidential review. Has that been adopted by Cabinet?
Mr. Chair, the understanding is that it has not fully been, it's not been adopted, but the government's departments must start to gear itself towards that.
But if it hasn't been adopted and you say we're aligning ourselves with that, isn't there a problem?
Well, we're
it's just a few people's opinion. Cabinet hasn't adopted it, so it's not the view of government. All right, I want you to give us a copy of that part of the review. I don't want the whole review. I want a copy of that part that you've relied on that impacts on this structure. The part of the report plus the recommendations. I want you to get that and give us that part of it. Or if you give us the whole review, I want it clearly marked which parts you relying on.
Mr. Chair, the document itself, the presidential review, I think it's got 37 recommendations, etc. The most pertinent ones are relating to the appointment of the boards and the appointment of the CEs. But I will certainly forward.
What I'm saying is I don't want us to read the whole thing.
Yes, just those parts.
Whatever impacts on this bill, I want to see those parts clearly marked in the report for us.
That's fine.
I've got some homework to do there.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right, well, look, it looks to me it's just really an institutional arrangement. I know DEAR wasn't very good when they did their proposals around this. I hope the Department of Water is a bit better. But we'll only see when we go through the bill whether all the issues are covered. As I said, the most important is to make sure that the board operates within a policy framework that is set out by the minister, or by the minister plus cabinet, doesn't matter. But I think that's the most important. It must make me sure from the beginning that this agency operates within that framework. Obviously, within that framework, it's got operational independence. Operational independence, not institutional autonomy, operational independence. Because you act in a policy framework of government. You guys must make sure you draft that properly. You'll never do it right. So I know. I don't even have to look at the bill. I know it'll be wrong. Make sure it's right. Mr. Naidu? Make sure it's right. Else, with the time limits available in this bill, it won't be passed. We're going to have big problems with the drafting on that. I can guarantee you this bill won't be passed. Policy framework in which it operates is vital. Okay. All right, let's have questions, comments, or is it clear at the moment? We'll see later on when we deal with the bill. Okay, Mr. Rogers, fine. I think it's just institutional stuff. And now remember, also, I want to say it now that you know that this bill won't be processed properly until we also have heard the institutional review report. So you can go and start working on how to draft that policy thing, but the institutional review is vital. There's a whole institutional review of this bill, so there can't be a separate institutional review somewhere that doesn't relate to this, okay? All right. Happy? Going? Gone? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Naidu. Mr. Naidu, I'm waiting for my speech.
Mr. Chair, before we... I don't know if you want to give Mr. Naidu an opportunity to talk about some of the issues while he's here. It seems like...
I've received a clear indication that this review report hasn't been processed yet, so let's not talk about it if it hasn't been processed through the department. Well, we're not dealing with the issues yet. I've just given you one warning where the problems are. I know you always make the same mistakes. I know the law advisors all make the same mistakes. So I'm advising all of you in advance that this bill will not process with the time limits. It's going to even be worse if you don't fix it up quickly and get it drafted correctly. Then you'll know the consequences. You will be dealing with a 71 act that can't be found on in word format. That is the consequence, Mr. Naidu. Okay. Right. Anything further from yours, Mr. Naidu, from your side? Everything clear? You can go and look at the latest drafts of DIA on what was it? On the SAWS bill, which we're going to hear about now. They've also got it wrong, but they're on the more on the right track in clause 4A in what they have drafted. But they haven't dealt with policy properly. Okay, thank you. Here's my dear. All right, members can sit back, kick their feet up, and wait for dear to arrive. We haven't called them yet.
Mr. Jim, may we be formally excused?
No, no, you can sit here for the rest of the day.
We
watch and listen and learn.
We have a parallel engagement on the policy review.
Never make double arrangements. Where have you ever made a date with a girl and you've got two dates? Huh? Can't make two dates. Okay, you're released.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, honorable members, thank you for the opportunity to give us this so that we could review very quickly, and then we'll take it from there. We'll take cognizance of the comments that you've made. Thank you.
We won't process the bill until we've had the institutional review, one. Two, I want the presidential review parts that are relevant. Three, start looking at making sure that policy is at the right place. Okay. Meeting will slow down for a minute until the other people are here. Like the original bill, but if you go and look at the amendments which I have here, that took place in the process. It's clear that some of the amendments we were proposing forms part of this bill, so they couldn't have been in this. So this can't be in the original bill. There had to be another one that had been introduced. So I think we must try and find it so that we can make sure what we're talking about. Because if it's correct that this is the bill, then the whole section on the removal of the CEO then was in this bill, and then now it's being removed by the same department that put it in there, which is difficult to understand if this is the real bill. So that's how we'll just start with this. Now, for those that weren't here on that occasion, basically, as I can recall, it was so long ago that in my notes I'm trying to look at, there were five main things that we amended. The first one was, remember, the controversial issue of the offence. Remember, a lot of people made submissions that the offence and the way it was drafted. The department, they arrived, they immediately admitted that that's not what their intention was, and we were prepared to amend that. So that was one. Number two was the issue of whether severe weather warnings should be issued by the weather services or the minister. This was raised by Mr. Morgan, and we felt that it should be the minister because such a warning has implications for society. And if an agency is not linked to government necessarily directly, like a minister is, just gives these warnings, there could be problems. Get up one day and give a warning. There's not been consultation with the Minister of Trade and Industry, whose industries have made the pollution falls probably under them. There's been no communication with the disaster management system. There's been no communication with the municipality where these factories are situated. So what we wanted is to try and create maybe to keep it that the weather service gives the warning, but to have a clause, something like that before this warning is issued, the minister will be informed of it, given all the necessary information for the decision, and be given a reasonable opportunity to consult with her colleagues, with any relevant stakeholders at the different levels of government. We didn't have to be specific about it. So something like that. That was the second issue. The third issue I recall was the issue of the removal of the CEO. That we felt that at that time, remember, there were many problems in different agencies and governments where CEOs were being removed, and then there wasn't a procedure, and then there's lengthy court cases and uncertainty for years at end because there are no proper procedures that have been created. How to remove a CEO, and then the courts start providing the procedures, not government. And we felt that there should be a procedure like that in the legislation, just to make it sure. We didn't want the roles for ourselves necessarily, we left it with the executive, but that there must be a procedure, and all these things must be done properly. So I remember that's the third thing. The fourth one was, I think, was again, the issue that I've just raised with the research thing is to what extent is this issue of policy properly contextualized within who makes the policy for the agency and so on, I think was the fourth one. And then I remember we didn't have full clarity on particularly Ms. Lotta, Dr. Lotta raised problems around to what extent it's all issues of air pollution, or whether it's, I don't know the difference in wording, but whether it's the ambient air or, you know. I remember she raised it, we then said the department's going to meet with her separately, and because it seemed to us she may have a point on some of the issues and so on. So I think that was one of the issues as well. I may, with my 55-year-old brain being what it is, which is not very good, I've had, it may be that I have forgotten, but I think those were, in any case, the major issues. I think the other problem was, one was a technical thing, but we were worried about it. I think there was, in the original bill, there there was a removal of the Minister of Finance having to approve, and we felt strongly that that would be wrong to do that, because that's how all agents in government work, so that could have also been a fifth or sixth point. In any case, those were some of the points that were raised last time, so I hope I've been able to. Now, we call for submissions on the bill. We only received one submission. You should have a copy. It's from Agri SA. It should have been given it just to you this morning. They have indicated that they are not interested to come and give an oral submission, so I've given this to Mr. Abada, to Advocate Abada, to tell us this morning what is in here and whether there's something we need to respond to. And then they themselves have received comments from public on their own process, which they would like to bring to our attention as well. Hopefully we'll get a copy of that some stage, if the department is prepared to release some of their information, not just talk to us in the air. So maybe we'll receive a copy of that as well. So what I would suggest we do, if the committee is happy, is them to brief us on the new bill, and as they do so, to say, this point you raised last time, we've accepted or not accepted, we've dealt with it, so we clearly know, and then when you finish with that, to go through the different submissions to tell us what is there, and then there'll probably be questions or comments or something. Everyone happy we do it like that? Okay. Well, you've got a package like this. Got it? Okay. Right, Mr. Advocate Abada or Ms. Beaumont, do you want to start saying something? Which one of you? Okay.
Chair, I think you've captured with your 55-year-old brain most of the issues that were contentious in terms of the last time that we were here. You did ask us also, Chair, at that meeting that we then do written submissions. It was on the 25th of July in relation to six issues specifically. And if you turn to tab one of the pack currently, those issues overlap with some of the issues that you've actually raised now in relation to some of the more contentious stuff. I think, and we will take you through the provisions related to the offences. But if you look at what you requested us the last time, Chair, the very first point was you wanted a written submission on the reasons why the clause on the removal of the CEO was removed from the bill. Then the second issue was why the minister should not issue the ambient air quality warnings. That was clause 3B. And then also you asked us to consider the inclusion under clause 4 of the minister's power to monitor the implementation by SOAS of any policies that were issued by the minister. Then you also said we should include or consider including a clause that provides for the minister's intervention in cases of failure by SOAS to implement the policies that the minister set. And then you also said in relation to that we should check that the similar provisions under the NEMLA Second Amendment Bill that were proposed by the committee. Then, Chair, you were quite correct in saying that the department must double-check all the technical comments that were raised during the public hearings and make sure that we address those, and that relates to Ms. Lotter and their submission as well. Then the final point that you wanted us to look at in relation to the Weather Services Amendment Bill is to check and consider the inclusion of a subsection under Clause 10 regarding the High Court's jurisdiction in situations where the human rights of individuals may be affected. And there you also asked us to check a similar provision under the Second Amendment Bill, NEMLA Second Amendment Bill. So, Chair, we've done the written submissions, as I said, under tab 1 of your document pack. They have been distributed, so I don't know if you want us to go through those, because those would deal with the issues that were raised on the 25th
no, look, whatever you think is the best way to explain it to us, do it like that. Go one to one of these amendments. I suppose the first issue is this distinction around air quality. You know, that not all of it, some of it, and so on. And then I know that you've also raised with me that you want a further amendment, even of what there is now, because it may not reflect the most optimum situation. So why don't you start with that one? And tell us what is there now that's different from the last time and what it is you will want to change further.
Okay, Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Bowman, who's the line function manager, to just take us through that.
Thank you. Thank you. It's
basically clause 1 and 2 and 3, I think. And 4, 5. Okay.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. This is really just a slight shift in emphasis, whereas what the existing bill does is include ambient air quality data, emissions, data in respect of emissions, and those could be industrial emissions or those could be greenhouse gas emissions. And then there's the question of the National Climatological Record, which links obviously with SORGE's current mandate. In the current discussions between SORGE and the Department of Environment Affairs, there has been some thinking around whether rather than being prescriptive about all of these different types of data being contained in the bill, that we rather have an enabling clause that allows for the inclusion of emissions data and greenhouse gas data. So this means that, for example, the National Atmospheric Emissions Inventory System, which is required to cover the emissions data and the greenhouse gas data, would be enabled through this bill rather than being prescribed as it is right now. So, Chair, that would have a small effect in respect of definitions, in respect of the amendment of Section 3, and the amendment of Section 4. And it would just really mean that we remove the emissions and greenhouse gas data from the provisions that are already under Section 3 and Section 4, and that we create rather an enabling clause, possibly under the Minister's supervisory powers.
So what that will mean is that ambient air quality will remain. And they'll have the power to do that. But you create an enabling clause that you can decide later what you want to do with emissions and greenhouse gases, whether it would be handed to SORGE or done internally in the department. You'll have a clause like that.
Yes.
So that is just a further amendment to what you've got here.
Yes, that would be a change.
Okay. Now, this is one of the issues that was raised particularly by Ms. Lotta, and maybe it will be easier for people to remember that deal with it one at one. Are there anything in the submissions that impact on this? Nothing in the submissions impact on this point. Okay. So, any of the members have any problem with that? So, you see, what they deal with here is they want to make sure that the people that have the knowledge and the technology which is SORGE are given a role to collect the information and the data around air quality, obviously within the framework provided by government. They went wider than air quality. They've added greenhouses and emissions. They've now on a rethink said, well, maybe we shouldn't go that far at this stage because it has implications to climate change and all the others other issues, and just to create an empowering clause to say that they can decide in the future where that should go. But at least everything as here on the air quality issues remain like it is, and that the custodian of that at this stage within the policy framework government will be dealt with by SAWS. And what the only issue that Ms. Lotte, Dr. Lotte, I can't remember the detail of it, but the wording that was in the previous, she said that goes far too wide. And what that will mean is that SAWS would be able to do a whole lot of stuff, which they don't do now. And it seemed, and then they had a meeting. In any case, then this is the wording they came up with. We haven't had a further comment from Dr. Lotte, but any comments on that? Any issues that anyone wants to raise? Or can we say that they go ahead with those amendments and we'll then have a look at it later and actually approve or not approve the amendments? Okay? Everyone happy like that? Okay? All right. The second issue around policy. Now, I see you've given me a wording here which is absolutely not what I spoke to you about previously. Because it doesn't say anything about policy. And it still has this horrible wording, wrong wording here, that you may issue directives on policy. And I've never heard something as bad as that from any lawyer drafted at any stage of their studies. No, you need a clause up front to firstly say that the policy framework in which the SAWS operates will be provided or given or whatever by the minister. That's what your first clause must say. Then this thing about minister supervisory powers is fine within that context. You do that on policy and then you say the agency will have operational independence within the when they operate within the policy framework set by the minister. So it's clear that first policy is the minister, but operational independence is the agency. And then you've got this clause here on the exercise and the monitoring and so on. Then under the directives, you can't say issue directives to the weather on policy. You say issue directives on any matter where the policy is not being complied with. That's what you issue a directive on, not on policy. Where there's no directive on any matter that are all non-compliance of policy. And when you say perform its functions, you must say perform its functions within the policy framework provided by the minister, subject to any norms and directives. You guys must get this right now. I don't understand. See, what I can't understand is I can't understand what it is you don't understand. Because I've said this now 100 times. Now, I'm having difficulty understanding what it is you're not understanding. So you must tell us today what it is you don't understand. I mean, the law advisor is there now. She came to me as well to say she's here to deal with this matter. So I want us to sort this thing out now. But you guys must tell us as a committee what is it you don't, either you don't agree with it and you're wording in a way that you think you can get around what we're saying. That's the one possibility. Or you're not understanding what we're saying. But you need to tell me what it is. What's the problem that we can't get this thing right? Okay? I'll give you a chance to say it now, but I need you to think about it. I'll give you now. So, and there's only 4A that you've now drafted to deal with this issue. Do we have to look at anything else? Are any of the submissions dealing with this issue? Yeah. Okay. Mr. Rogers.
Thanks, Chair. I'm sure I raised this the last time we looked at this bill. It appears to me as though 4AC and D services must perform its functions subject to any norms and standards. Should we not include the norms, in other words, may under C should become must set norms and standards? Then at least there's no grey area. Because at the moment we've got grey areas here. Thanks, Jim.
Well, you see, if they draft this thing correctly with, by starting with the policy, then the norms and standards can be made, because the policy must be a policy. Then you may want to add to the policy through norms and standards, and so then it can maybe be made. But you're right, if it's not going to be, then it may not be what it is we want to do. So I think that that's a valid question being asked. What is the problem, Ms. Bowen? What is it that is not being understood? Let me start again, and then you tell me. If you look at the Constitution is very clear that when it comes to policy formulation, that job is the job of the executive. When it comes to legislative functions, that job is our job. So, when someone wrote in a law I looked at the other day and said that the Chief Justice will issue regulations, I look at that and I say to myself, that is unconstitutional, because the legislative function is given to us, and the practice in government is that if you give the power to make regulations, the only person you can give it to is the executive. Here it's given to the Chief Justice, who's not part of the executive, and so that is why when you look at the Constitution, you have to look at how you exercise the power and who can exercise the power of the legislature. Now, the same thing with executive. We keep on, that's why I'm saying also the law advisors don't draft these things correctly. Because if any one of them sat there, or any one of the lawyers in your department sat there, and they look at this and they say, who makes policy? They'll say, the executive makes policy. What practices do they exist in government all over the world to actually give that power? The usual power is to delegate some of that to someone. Okay. Now, but policy must be set by the executive. What happens in this instance is most agencies that we create in government, they're fulfilling government functions. Agencies fulfill what it used to be. If you look back and at years back, all those functions we're giving to agencies today used to be exercised by government. Now, some reasons, there are some good reasons to give power to agencies. Sometimes, for example, with SAS, when they created SAS, what they saw in SAS is that if they keep the salary band of a civil servant in SAS, they're never going to get the quality of staff they need in SAS to create a proper service. So then they create an agency and say that the usual rules of civil service don't apply, that this structure will create its own with the minister. So you create an agency to perform a particular function that government fulfills, but you create it in this instance because you also need to change the way the framework of the staff awards so that you can get staff at a higher salary to work for SAS than you will in the civil service. Otherwise, all those people get a certain thing. You will never get accountants and people like that to come and work because they won't come. So that's not a reason why you create an agency. Other agencies are created because the function should really be exercised by someone independently. So government is already the regulator overall and da-da-da. So you don't necessarily want government to fulfill that function because then you'll have possibly have a conflict of interest. You can have easier problems of corruption. So you create an agency to create so that structure. So, you know, your independent broadcasting authority, your CENTEC in the communications sector are examples where you need to have someone between the industry and government to be able to regulate. So you create an agency. But a lot of agencies are created in government for a lot of other reasons. I mean, you look at the water sector. They create all these
area to be closer in the Mpumalanga so that they create an agency and they're able to fulfill certain water functions. But what do we do? Once we create an agency, we put a board on top of it. We create, now we create layers of complex and difficulties we're going to get. Now, so what I'm saying to you here is everyone agrees that the water services must be an agency. Because there's skills in that, and there's a salary structure and everything. We want someone to fulfill, not necessarily in government. And also it may be complex if government start giving weather forecasts and so on, then government becomes God. So now you create an agency, but we're all happy with that. There must be an agency. But the policies in which that agency operates has to, in terms of the constitution, be in the hands of the executive. So the first clause you must always have if you've got an agency is that the policy framework that is set must be provided for by the minister. Then for safety's sake, because you don't want the minister to interfere all the time, to say, I'm making policy so I can interfere all the time, you say that operational independence rests with the agency. So that they don't have to. Then you create mechanisms like you've got in four. The minister must monitor the policy, and the minister can issue norms and standards or directives where the policy is not being complied with or has to be supplemented or whatever, whatever. That is how the framework must work. So what do we have? We have, at the end of the day, we have an agency that works completely independently in terms of its operational decisions and everything it does. But if it is varying off from what we want in government for it to do, it starts doing other things in terms of the fund. Then we want to be sure that the minister can actually say, but you're not complying with policies, then you can't do that. Here's a directive, etc. So you want to create the policy framework by government, but you don't want government to interfere in every little decision. You want the agency to be operating independently, but they must do it within the framework of the policy. And only if the policy is not being complied with, or the norms and standards have to be set by, then that is something you can do and obviously impose on the agency. I mean, are we understanding what it is? It flows from the Constitution. Now, people will say to me, but you don't really have to put it here. No, you do. Because if you go and look at many agencies, people will tell you that the policies have been made by that agency. Because in practice, if the minister is not obliged to set it there, in practice what happens, they develop the policies. So you don't want that. I mean, is it clear?
Chair, it is clear. And I think... as you correctly pointed out, if you look at the first one, must monitor the exercise and performance of the weather services of its function. So it's an attempt for us on our part to actually get them to comply with policy.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
This is the second stage.
Yeah, I agree with you that it needs to be explicit.
Yeah.
Advised by Mr. Shabalala that the space agency has exactly that. So we look at their clause in terms of how they drafted it.
Yeah, but the same, I gave you the wording now. So
yeah.
You can work
yeah.
on that wording.
But we are in agreement, Chair.
And then the way Mr. Rogers raises will
the
last on that.
Yes.
Then maybe norms and standards will be a maybe, okay. Because you've got a policy and it will only be if you want to add norms and standards, which is not in the policy, then that is a possibility. Ms. Bowman?
No, thank you, Chair, and I think that's very helpful. I think that in the case of the custodianship of the South African Air Quality Information System and the role of South African Weather Services in the air quality data management issues, it has been a new partnership to some extent. And so there's been a bit of exploration and refinement that has been needed on the nature of the distinction between what the agency is responsible for and what the department, and of course air quality is complicated because it's not only a concurrent competency, it also has licensing authorities at local government level. So there has been some complexity in clarifying and refining the nature of that relationship, and I think that
if you've got the other clause correct, then that doesn't matter. Then you can sort out the detail later. If you've got a clause that the minister
don't have that, then if you hand over a new function to source, then the policy is then starting to be made by source. Then you get problems. So once you sorted out the other framework to say that the policy framework is set by the ministry, and it's only in these instances the minister can intervene. Once you've done that, then all the other details, if you don't sort it out now, it's fine, because there's no problem to sort it out down the line. Because they're not allowed to act outside any policy framework set by the minister. So you sort it out as we go along. Any further issues and questions on this issue? Let's see how they go and draft this and so on, okay? So that's the second set of amendments that we need. Now, the third issue was the issue of who will issue a weather warning. This is the issue that I said Mr. Morgan had raised and the committee had agreed to. Now, the department has, in all their wisdom, rejected every single thing we said and gone back to what they had without any attempt to try and accommodate this foolish committee who has no clear ideas of things and no reason for raising stuff. So which clause is it again? The one that says, yeah, fine. Clause 3, which is section 4, and under the B, it's subsection 5, the weather service may issue ambient quality air quality forecasts, which we don't have problems with. But it's the second part, ambient air quality warnings. Now, if you want to keep it like that, because clearly you're clinging to it for dear life, for some unknown reason that I can't fathom, if you want to cling to this so dearly, then at least accommodate the committee and have a clause there that says that before such a warning can be given, the minister must be informed, number one. Number two, the minister must be provided with all the information necessary that was necessary to make the decision by the weather services. And number three, the minister must be given a reasonable opportunity to consult with any possible stakeholders in government, at any level of government, on which such a decision may impact. TG, is there any possibility in the world that you can at least accommodate that? That we've raised over and over and over, and you've come back and just flatly rejected. Is there any possibility that this can be accommodated? We apologize for our foolishness. Can I apologize for our foolishness as a committee? But if you can accommodate this, this would be so nice.
Come back with that formulation.
That will be amazing. Great. Anyone want to add from the committee side this big concession that's been made by the department? Huge concession that the department has accommodated this foolish committee. Oh, so nice to get a bit of cooperation from the department. All right, so that is the third area they'll work on. Let's come to this big problem later, because they had such bad answers. I don't want to get upset. Now, the fourth big area was the offences. Now, this was the big public outcry. Remember what it said previously, you must get written permission before you give a weather warning. And that had created huge problems, because if the person is out there at sea, on their walkie-talkie, and there's a big storm rolling in, and waves and a tsunami coming along, and then say, can I please put me through to the CEO of Weather Services, I can get permission to give this warning while I'm here at sea and this tsunami is just about to overtake and throw my boat over. And then the receptionist at Weather Services says, just hold, the CEO is busy at the moment. Now, clearly, they can't work like that. And we've all agreed. So we've got a new wording that basically says no person may publish, disseminate, or distribute in any manner whatsoever any severe weather warning. Now, imagine there's a definition of severe weather warning, which he or she believes or ought to have reasonably known or suspected to be false or misleading. That's what we were interested in. Not and or. Oh, that's the part. Hey, Mr. Abada. It mustn't be and. It must be or. The second part is the part that's on a hoax, Mr. Shabalala. You were here. It's all that may incite public reaction and may lead to undue mobilization of resources, public alarm evacuation. That is your hoax. We're trying to legislate for our hoax. You get those hoaxes all the time. Someone says there's white powder, put it in a packet, it creates a huge panic because everyone thinks it's anthrax. Same thing with this, someone does a hoax where it could be that false and misleading falls under it, but it could be also that it doesn't. So we've also created, but it was an or, not an and. So that I think captures the kind of things that we wanted to make offences, and it looks like the department's happy with it, except for the and. Unless you want to convince me the and should be there.
No, we don't. We'll include the or. But I just want to mention here, Chair, in terms of the comments that we've received from members of the public, there is still a bit of unhappiness in terms of the suggestions. There's quite a bit of comment from the public in relation to this clause specifically.
But saying what?
Saying that in some instances it's still vague, it's draconian in some instances.
But they may just not lie, that's all. If they don't lie, they won't be guilty of anything. What happened to the clause that we said that this must only be prosecuted by the National Prosecuting Authority? The decision to prosecute.
The High Court?
No. We said prosecuting. We said that to avoid that any person will be prosecuted for the smallest little infringement, that what you do is you make the decision to prosecute to be taken at the highest level possible. That seems to have fallen away here.
I mean, the clause that was written.
No, the other clause on the
whenever a person laid charges relating to an incident as contemplated in Section 1, the Director of Public Prosecution.
Which one is that? That's the one I'm looking for.
And it's page 17.
No, we only got 5 pages.
Can you check your version? So.
In the committee's one. Yeah, you see, I said we did it. Now you've removed it again. As you've done with everything we've said. Every single thing we said you've removed. No wonder that the public's moaning. Why do you remove it? What on earth will move this department to remove that? And don't tell me it's the minister, because the minister will never have looked at this. It's you, the staff, the officials.
The clause says whenever a person lays charges relating to an incident contemplated in paragraph A, subsection 1, the DPP in the area where the incident occurred must take the decision whether to institute criminal proceedings on behalf of the state, him or herself.
It mustn't be the DPP is your deputy.
It's the Director of Public Prosecution.
That's your provincial. That's fine. That's your provincial person. It's not your local prosecutor in the local area. Now, why did you remove that?
I think the difficulty that we had in that instance, Chair, is that the Justice Department has their own system of deciding on prosecution.
a single thing we said about this book. Every single thing we did, except for the offense, you remove from this bill that we said. I have great difficulty understanding the attitude of the department. I understand the bill was withdrawn. It's a deliberate decision. It's not a technical error. I mean, you've heard that Mr. Abada. He has different views on the issue, so he just removes it, despite what the committee said.
Yeah, maybe I'm looking at it from a departmental perspective, and I should have been looking at it from a parliamentary perspective. So instead of the DPP, what would...
Don't look at a parliamentary perspective.
Yeah.
Look at it from the public's perspective. The public came to this committee and said, these are draconian things you're coming with. You guys came to us and said, we agree. Well, that's not what we intended. So, the public is still worried that something like this is an impact on the freedom of speech. Now, I've got no problem to limit the freedom of speech if people are falsely saying things, if they're creating hoaxes that are created by the public, we can create huge havoc in society. I've got no problems to limit freedom of speech in instances like that. So, we reword the crime. But we say, but let us be sensitive to the public's need, that they don't want every little possibility of a false warning being given where there's been no impact. Nothing happened, no one listened to the person, because they know the man is mad. He's standing up there saying, you know, that here is a tsunami coming. Of course, he's giving false statements in public. So theoretically, he can be prosecuted, standing there in the middle of it. But everyone looks at this oath and says, look, he's a maliki man. This is a maliki, this one. No one knows that that's not going to happen, and nothing happened, and no one listened to them, and there's a problem. Theoretically, in terms of this clause, that person could be prosecuted. Now, take a lesser case. A 15-year-old boy saying something to his schoolmates, and they spread it on email or whatever. Nothing happens. There's no huge damage done with it. Again, that boy can be prosecuted. 15 years old, trying to make some hoax. So what did we as a committee say in our wisdom? Okay. Let us be sensitive to what. We have got no problem to saying if people lie, if they create hope, we're going to hit them with a crime. But there can be cases that are so minimal that fall in that category that you don't want prosecuted. So how did we want to deal with it as a committee? There's only one way of dealing with it. And that is to create a guideline or a prescript in a law for how the prosecuting authority will deal with the matter. Because they decide to prosecute. So we say we don't interfere with your right to prosecute, but when you prosecute this matter, do it at the highest level in that province. What are we doing? We are looking at the sensitivity of the public in this case. There was a huge outcry about freedom of speech. Here we try and accommodate it and try and write a guideline to it, and it's just ignored. So that's, you see, what my problem is. This is not a question of thinking something, it's a question of not thinking at all, I'm afraid. Not thinking at all, and not listening to the debates that took place in this committee. The members that were there sitting here, they listened to all these debates while we did it. Hey, you see what this means now? I have to go and read every damn thing again to go and make sure that you haven't taken out more stuff. Because for you it's just natural, we just take it out. You don't care what this committee did. But now what it does for me is it creates extra work.
our document there says 38, section 38, page 17. Whenever a person lays charges,
persons convicted upon proof, convicted. Which number is in this package?
3.
3. Hmm. 3 is a, 3 is like a table. Clause was developed by the department, not by us. instructions, they went to develop a clause. We engaged on it and fixed it up until the stage where we reached a clause which I thought was a very clear one in law, that in a case, and remember what we're talking about here, we're talking about a case here where the relationship has broken down between the minister and the chief executive officer, as has happened with some of these boards and some of these agencies. So, I mean, they're not talking to each other, they're fighting with each other. So you need something in law that will then say, how do you deal with this? And they drafted a whole clause which has now been completely removed, and it started off with dealing with that how it's appointed, for how long it's appointed, the procedure of the appointment, the subject, and then the conditions of employment, very important. What did CO is responsible for? What is their job? That was there. Annual performance agreement was, we put that in there. Annual performance agreement, we put it, it's in there. That is there. That is the chief observer, obviously, is accountable to the board to create that link legally. It doesn't exist in the present legislation. Present legislation is just left open. Just like that. There's nothing. When there is, then we dealt with what happens when there's a vacancy, which I think is in the law at the moment, but this is just a bit more in detail.
Chair,
share the other difficulties that, in terms of our other legislation, that sets sort of the parameters for CEOs. We've got other parastatal or entities, Chair, where we don't have these provisions as well. And I can't remember whether we actually explained to the committee on the last occasion, Chair, that we are trying to find this uniformity in terms of dealing with specific.
Well, if that legislation was in front of me, I would have raised all these issues, not in front of them. So the mere fact that you're doing some work behind the scenes, what has that got to do with me? There's now a bill in front of me. A bill is in front of me. This committee must pass that bill. One day, when the relationship breaks down between the CEO of SOARS and the minister, or the DG, then people tell me, but you passed the bill, you didn't look at it, you didn't make sure there was a provision that provided for this. That's what they said to me and this committee. I'm not interested in the fact that your other legislation doesn't have this. It's exactly what I'm telling you, how much of your legislation that doesn't work well. I mean, the whole issue of policy issues is not in your legislation. Now, what are you saying to me? Now, one day we must wait till you've now done all, and this has now been going on for years. This bill is 2011, now 2013. 2 years later, you know this is a problem with the committee. 2 years later, we still don't have anything on the table. So how can I be referred back to other pieces of legislation that just doesn't affect me? Because that legislation is in front of me. If that legislation was here, this committee and myself would raise the same problems. We'll say, but there's no procedure for removal of CEO.
Chair, I think that you are right that the minister acted on this advice, but at the same time, what I understood he raised was the fact that when she brought the amendment bill, particularly to deal with the alignment in the area of appointing the CEO with other pieces of legislation for the other entities, because through our governance framework, we picked up that in weather services we did not have some of those provisions on the appointment of the CEO process, whilst they exist in others. Basically because Cabinet made a decision also on the procedure after the various pieces of legislation already in place. So the minister's view was that she would not want to have a different provision for CEO in the Weather Services Act when it is not similar in the other.
But it's not similar in the other because the others don't have it.
Yes, they don't.
So that's not an argument. The others don't have it.
Yes,
so you can't say, I don't want something similar to. The others don't have it.
Yes, I'm saying.
And it should have it.
I understand, Chair, but I'm saying that now that we've had this discussion, maybe we then have to discuss further with the Minister on how we then facilitate the need, the requirement as specified by the committee. Can I request that we clarify?
Have a look at it, and DG, the issue is not trying to be difficult or anything. The issue is that it's the reality of government. If you have a board, you have a CEO and you have a minister. We have proven in our country and in every country in the world that there are instances that those relationships break down. Now, you're not just dealing with a minister and a CEO. There's a board. The minister can't do anything if the board doesn't. Now, what happens in the cases like what happened in the SABC and others, the CEO and the board completely, the relationship breaks down. They don't talk to each other, they just take each other to court. Now, you want to get rid of it. Now, what we're saying is, set out a procedure here that is very clear, that you can then go ahead with this procedure. Because what is happening now is when you want that the board wants to get rid of the CEO runs to court all the time and blocks it because they say there's no procedure. I want to say here that there is a procedure, so now you can go ahead and you can follow this procedure, and the court can't stop you to do it. Whereas in the other one, the court stops you from doing it. Now, you see, the problem I have with this, ultimately I must tell you, if you tell me that you don't want this, I'll pass this bill. But I will do it, and I will not be able to
physically get up, and this committee cannot physically get up and say, we support these clauses, we support this, this clause. We just do it because we've reached a stalemate. Because the problem is we have identified a problem. And the answer from the department cannot be that my other legislation doesn't have it, and therefore we don't want to create some. That's not an answer. The other legislation should have the same procedure, and those bills should have been before this parliament already to amend this procedure. Go and look at this clause again, DC. You guys drafted it. We didn't draft it. And what it tells you very clearly, step for step, the chief officer of the case, his or her office, in the case of resignation, upon this, subject to this and this, you will then do this. The minister will do that, the board will do that, the chief executive. Now, if you've got a clause like this, and it takes a year for you to act against a CEO that's not operating, this committee can call you before parliament and say to you, but why aren't you doing anything? Why? Here's the procedure. Why haven't you done these steps? Then we can get an answer from you. Now, if we ask you the question, you're going to just tell us, but this person doesn't want to cooperate with us. And we're not getting cooperation. And every time we want to do something, we have to go to court. That shouldn't be your answer to me. There has to be a procedure for this. And if Mr. Abada is right about the labor laws, which I'd like to see, then bring me an opinion like that, that I can see it. That there's all these things apply. But I know it doesn't apply. The specifics of a removal of a... Because what you have got here is you've got a board, you've got a CEO, and you've got a minister. Don't just have an employee-employee relationship. You've got a whole lot of entities that all play a role in the removal of the person. You don't just have one person, the boss of a factory, that says, you didn't do this, I'm going to get rid of you. I'm going to have a disciplinary hearing, this is it. Here, is there no procedures for these guys? So what you need to do is to get this relationship between the board, the CEO, and to work it out. And the only place you work it out is legislation. And to supplement it in regulation. So...
We'll look at it.
No, I know you're going to look at it. Because I know you would have looked at it even if you didn't say so, you would look at it. But the point is, I wanted to sink in what the problem is. This is not just... I mean, this committee is not difficult to say, well, we don't. This committee is looking at it. It's got a clause. I'll tell you the clause in the bill. Where's the original? There's a clause here that deals with it. It just says something on removal. It's got like one word. That's how we picked it up. It's got one word that says you can remove or something. I'm saying the problem is that clause doesn't cater for the tripod of relations before you can remove. And that's what we're trying to spell out here. Okay. Anyone want to add to that? Happy? Not happy, but I mean... But the committee repeats what it said last time and wants to see what we had last time. Okay? Cross-party lines, you see. It's cross. It's not just the chair saying so. Mr. Abada? Now, where's the original act? I want to see that clause on the treasury. I see you've now removed this again. Again, you didn't listen to the committee, you just got it back there. Subject to section 18. What is 18? What was, just in the original act, what is section 18?
Yes, section 18 in the original act relates to transfer of staff chief director to whoever serves. That's in the original act.
Okay, so that one is you just make the board the accounting authority.
Okay.
Mid Original Active.
So just give me that, those clauses where it deals with staff and finances. Oh, here it is, man. Listen, number 9.5, remuneration. Here you've taken out the Minister of Finance. Why are we doing that? It was previously 9. So aren't you amending that? Now you've removed it completely. Not in this amendment. If it is like it, I'm happy. Because then it means you're not amending 9. You didn't come back with it. Okay, so that you at least adhere to. Good God, they did
just one thing.
You know, and you can see they did it without knowing what they're doing. You see? Yes, you're preaching something without knowing it.
Governance letters, we have a system that works currently, but I think we probably not be so clear on how that system must then be in law, because all public entities of GIA, we have to develop an HR plan, and that framework is also contained with by the Minister of Finance.
Yeah, that's always
it deals with the financials, how you pay salaries, how you benchmark salaries and all of that. So I guess that the key thing is that the team probably and us, we thought it's a given, it works, and we never really thought it's something that...
This one here was the members of the board salary. You took out the words with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, and we were opposed to that. Now, I see this time you've removed that amendment completely, so then we don't have a problem. Where? Because you're not continuing with that amendment in the new bill. The only two clauses you've got here is 6 and 7. 6 says that the chief executive may on such terms and conditions serve as determined by the board, appoint such number. How would we know that where the story that the DG has just given of the HR plans, that's not spelled out here. Where would we find that they are bound by the HR plans of the department? Which clause will say that? Because this one wouldn't do it like that. This says the board determines the staff complement. And that can't be. It has to be subject to treasury. Now, if you've got another clause somewhere else that says that the HR plans are approved with the minister and with treasury, then that's fine. But then I need to see that other clause. Because just as this clause stands, I think this would be problematic. Don't you think, Gigi? Because
yes.
That doesn't capture what you just
told.
Yeah,
I think we must have that clause expanded to include the approved HR plan concurrently.
Either that or minister approving with the Minister of Treasury,
with
the two of them.
Yeah.
But it may be that there's a clause elsewhere that deals with it, then we don't need it as a double. But will you just check that? Check. If clause 4 approval, because you see what the problem is here, and treasury, just as you've got it here, it'll mean that the board can on its own decide on a plan, an HR plan for it that doesn't take its budget into consideration at all, doesn't, and then it has to be funded from treasury, without treasury ever having a say in it. If it's just written like this. And the reason why it's now difficult is because you've changed the context of it. You see, previously you said it depends on subject to section 18 and it dealt with secondment. Now you've changed it into an HR plan, and but you've not linked it back to the department and to treasury. And then the next clause is the standard practice that if there are boards, they are made the accounting authority and not the CEO, obviously. Because the CEO is basically your equivalent of your DG, being accountable to the minister, and then the CEO is accountable to the board. So that is in line with the practice. I don't like the practice personally, but I know that that's the practice that exists. And the reason I don't like it is because most of these boards aren't permanent. So for them to be like the accounting authority is basically meaningless, because your CEO really runs the place. Whereas in politics, your minister is at work every single day and part of the process. So that's why I say I don't like this setup, but I suppose it's the best we can get under the circumstances. Okay, so that is also now need to be dealt with further. Were there any other issues that... let me first ask you, are there any other issues in the submissions? Were the submissions you received just the ones on the offences? And what did Agri SA say in their submission?
Chair, they're also looking at clause 10.
Okay.
Insertion of section 38, which is the criminal sanction. And then they also made some comments in relation to the definitions, specifically around disseminate, distribute, publish, and the severe weather warning as well. Chair, in terms of our issues, there were comments around advisory services, the ambient air quality forecast, ambient air quality information. The minister's supervisory powers, there was a comment on that from Kaya, that's Lotte, Lorraine Lotte and him. Then there was a comment around the board and its composition and staff and conditions of service as well. There was substantive comment on the limitation of liability clause. And then there was also clause 10, Kaya again, Earthlife Africa, and that's the offences and penalties. The guys with the radios, the Hamnet emergency communications, also made input again on that provision. So did Mr. Corbus Porta from Corbus Porta Weather. Mr. Juan de Blanche from SODOS. And then there was also comment on clause 11 of Schedule 1, Public Goods Services.
I don't just want to know that there's comment.
Are
any of those comments substantial and have they been dealt with?
Chair, what we'll do is we'll provide the committee with a detailed comments and response report as we normally do.
And then Agri as well?
Yes.
Okay.
So what we'll do is we'll indicate what our response is to each of those comments as well as whether we agree with them or don't agree with them for the committee's consideration.
Yeah, these Agri ones I don't think are, they raise stuff, but the stuff they raise I don't think are of any significance. Now, what are these schedules? Oh, I know what the other issue was, I forgot. In the previous bill, you gave a clause where you gave power to the minister to amend schedules. And that, I told you there was a judgment that you brought the judgment to us, we read it, where you can't can't give a minister the power to amend legislation. In fact, there the president was given power to amend regulations in the public service. And the court upheld, the constitutional court held it, okay, you can't do that. I mean, the legislative power vests in the legislator. So that clause has now been removed, and you've now put amendments to the schedules in here. So every time you want to amend the schedules, the principle remains. You have to come to Parliament to amend that. And the minister can't just amend the schedule. That would be unconstitutional. We agreed on that. That's the other amendment I forgot. Was the other amendment. Is that right? You left that out now. Okay. Right. All right. Anything else? Yes, Mr. Shabalala.
So the other thing I think that you mentioned was on the comments that the last, the 21, was that the Act comes to operation on publication in the Gazette by the President.
Now you know that this committee's position, that that's wrong. We don't allow this anymore. This committee doesn't anymore say on a date fixed by the President by proclamation. Because what that means is the minister has to send a proclamation to the President. And therefore, we've had bills that have lain with the President. I know the bill where the one was about shooting, when a policeman may shoot someone. That bill lay for, I think, almost 10 years with the President, was never signed. Until it came back to Parliament, was slight, one-word amendment was made, and then suddenly it was signed. Police blocked that. Because what happens is, when the President gets the proclamation, then other ministers can say, but we don't agree with this. So then the thing doesn't take place. So we have agreed that from now on, you must tell us, it's your responsibility as a department to tell us which clauses in this Act can't be immediately implemented. And like we did with NEMLA, we then say, these clauses come into operation immediately, and these one will come into operation, whatever you tell us. It will take you a year to get them operational. But that there's a finality in the clause that they ask you. So that you know that's not our approach anymore. This is something other. It's just wrong. Because this is how you undermine Parliament.
We will use the language that was used in the
NEMLA. Yeah, just use a similar wording.
But now after we published, we received comments that seemed to also create another confusion in the public, because the understanding of the president publishing is understood as being through a notice. In a gazette, which is not the case. The president does not put out a notice. But maybe what we need to say is that on the date of publishing on the gazette, so that there is no expectation of a separate notice. So that might just be a
slight. We made it clear the other thing, that notice the publication refers to section 80, a publication by the president in terms of section 81 in the constitution. So that must be spelled out like we did in NEMLA. So you don't just say public in a gazette, because it means that you can then, the minister can publish in a government gazette and it will come into operation, which is not what the intention is. It's linked to section 81 of the constitution, so it must be linked to that. So it will either be, and all the clauses here that can come into, and it looked like to me like all these clauses in operation immediately, it will just be, it will become on the date that the publication takes place in the Gazette by the President of the Session. It's not after 3 months or something. After 3 months, if you come and tell me this will take 3 months, that will take 1 year, then we change that. This one will be, all these clauses are immediate. I can't see any reason for any of these. But again, it's open to you to come and tell us that no, clause one, you'll have to wait, the ambient, can't take place until 1 year or whatever, okay? But we must do it like that. Parliament must take this power on. We had a whole discussion in the committee around this, so we're not going to repeat that. But we are, in principle, now have agreed from now on we deal with acts like this. And then this one of the schedules, I'm assuming those, there's been no comment on it, so I'm assuming they're fine. And that now it will be that it's, the schedules are amended in the usual course of events and not by the minister.
Huh? On our side, sir, there were comments on the there were a few comments on the schedule 1 and 2. The schedule 1 talks of deals with the public good service, and then schedule 2 deals with the commercial service. But the comments basically related to the assurance that it was public good service, the information that they can get free of charge, that the SOG is not going to charge them for that type of important information. So I think that's the comments.
Which one is that number? Which one of the
schedule 1
number?
On the 2013 bill, that's on page 5.
Mm-hmm. Which one are you saying there? The first one there?
Yes.
The conducting of research focused on reducing the impact of weather-related natural disasters and improving the quality of public good services.
Yeah. Also, because they regarded the information on SACWIS as information that they can access anytime when they want to.
Mm.
So that's one of the assurance that is still not actually there, supposed to be there.
And what are you saying that it won't be affected? You're happy with the wording as it is, won't affect them getting that information free?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when you make the comments on the submission, then spell that out for us, okay? Clearly. Okay, so there was one comment on these schedules, okay? And they'll respond to it more fully.
And Chair, if I may, there would be consequential amendments in respect of the issue that we raised right up front around inclusion of emissions and industry emissions and greenhouse gas emissions as a consequential amendment.
Yeah, no, you must make all the amendments that flow from that. From anything, you make all the amendments. All right, are there any other issues we've not covered? Anything the members want to raise? Mr. Rogers?
Thanks, Chair. You say you're a 54-year-old with a battling brain. Well, I'm a rural boy, so I'm battling to keep up here. Just two things I want to raise, Chair. Section 30, subsection 6, did we not discuss the difference between a higher prosecuting authority versus a magistrate's court? I'm not quite sure if we've addressed that under offences and penalties.
The two are different. The one is who decides to prosecute, and then once that decision is made, then it's which court will it take place? Well, then you've got district courts, you've got regional courts, and you've got higher courts. And all this does, it gives the users of the experience difference. Each courts, as you go from the bottom, have a jurisdiction. So a district court can only do cases up to that level. A da-da-da can only do that. When you sign a lease agreement or when you buy your car or something, you'll see one of the clauses right at the end. It says the magistrate's court will have jurisdiction. It's because the amount may go above the jurisdiction. But the costs that lawyers can charge are the lowest in the lowest court. You understand? So you want to do the case in that court so that the costs are low and that court can have this jurisdiction. So there are exceptions created to the jurisdiction. The same with criminal matters. Then what you do is you say that this decision where to prosecute rests with the prosecuting authority. And what this clause does, it just tells them once you've made the decision to prosecute, we're saying you can do it in any court, including the lowest court. So it may be a case that you don't want to take to the High Court. Or it may be a hoax that has created billions and billions and billions of rands of damage, then you do want to do it in the High Court. But if it didn't do that, the person lied or went out falsely, people acted on it, but luckily not too much happened, then you want to charge them in the district court or in the regional court, that'll allow. So this just tells you, it doesn't matter what the possibility of the sentence is, you can also do it in the district court. So it gives you the possibility.
responsibility to do in all of them. So the decision to prosecute is one thing. Where to prosecute is another thing. You need to cater for both of those.
Okay, and then just my second question is quite an interesting issue raised by AgriSA, where Clause 27A exempts SAWS employees from acting in good faith for any claims, any loss in claims.
Yeah.
It's quite a good point that they raise there. What would the case be if an employee of SAWS did not act in good faith? What would the consequences be?
Well, if the employee falls under what we've created an offence now, false or misleading information, then clearly that clause doesn't help them and they will be charged as well. So every SA says, but now you're protecting the one unknown. What we're doing is we're saying if you're acting in good faith, you can never, if you make a false statement or a misleading statement or hoax, you can never be acting in good faith. Never. Because false threats, if you act falsely, you have the intention. You can't act in good faith if you have the intention to act falsely or misleading. Yeah, employees or anyone else. But, of course, the liability issue is just the usual clause of liability. If the civil servant acts in good faith, then clearly there's not consequences to it. But if they were to give misleading information, false information, they'll fall under the same, under the... Because it says no person, doesn't say employees of SAWS are relieved from it. They give false or misleading information, or they create a hoax, of course, they'll also be charged with this offence. So I don't think Agri has read it correctly. As, that's why I said just now, they made it thing, but they've not read that thing correctly. Things are very separate. In fact, if the wording was as it was in the first bill, then Agri would have a point. But now in this bill, where good faith and false and misleading are two very distinct sides of, this, of the same coin, if you do the one, then all of us, anyone in the public or an employee, of, if they're acting false or misleading, that'll be an offence. Okay. Anything else? All right, so we've given a whole lot of instructions. Some of it, I assume, is not going to be complied with. Because it wasn't complied with the first time, so I'm not sure we're going to be lucky on the second time. But we made it clear where we have difficulties and so on, and we need you to go and look at this. That policy issue needs to be sorted out. I think they understand what it is now. This ambient thing, the distinction has to be sorted out. The salary thing with the board has to be sorted out. The offensive thing must be made sure that what we... Particularly the prosecuting thing must go in there. All the comments have to be there. Two things that are not in this bill that were a problem last time was the minister's right to amend the schedules, which has been removed, and the removal of the treasury with the salaries of the board has also now been removed as an amendment, so we don't have to worry about those anymore. And then all the other issues are dealt with. Now, and I think that the only issue that we probably won't, maybe there'll be a difference, is this thing of the chief executive officer. But I think that you guys must please go and not, I mean, I know that Mr. Obama is, whatever he said here, he said it in good faith. So he didn't try and be false in this meeting, otherwise he would have been thrown with his book here. So he's acted in good faith with the statements he's made. But you see, just logic will just tell you that everything about the basic rules of employment, that firstly applies to workers. And if it were to apply to your higher ones, it'd have to make specifically like that. And if it did, then it would be that legislation in this country is contradictory. Because every single legislation in this country, except for DIA, has got procedures for removal and appointment of people in agencies, not in anything. Where there is a board involved, there's a CEO involved, and a minister involved, sometimes even a DG, have those related. Now that has to be spelled out. It doesn't just naturally get covered. The national principle of employment law will cover it, but not the national principle of procedures. That's different.
not the principles, not the procedures. Okay, so let's try and sort this out and get it to a stage. There is nothing wrong. This can only, what we've got in this, in the previous bill, is only protection for the department and for the minister. Because now immediately the minister then have a procedure that can be followed. And they can make sure the CEO and the board follows the procedure. Well, they don't have to invent one. Because then you get into huge trouble. Because then you are the person that is dealing with getting rid of the person and you are making procedures to do it. No court will ever allow that. No court will ever allow that in the wildest dreams. And you can be the person that is part of a process to get rid of someone and you then make the rules as you go along. There has to be rules. Otherwise the courts are going to create the rules. Okay? Alright. Anything else from this side? DG, from your side?
No, we understand the concerns and the reasons better now. Yeah. I think we are much clearer. Thank you.
Right. Now remember, these things can't be done next year. You have to do it now. And you have to get back to us and tell us. You ready? And when you say ready, it means fully ready to accommodate everything the committee has. Okay. What is the time? Okay, we'll have a short break and then we'll spend the rest of the day or the rest of the morning on ICM, continue with that, okay? Alright, let's have a break.
Over the body, and the DG, I recall, said that's fine. it would be okay for us to retain it, which means that we now have to relook at the structure of the Act and see whether, if we are going to retain the National Committee, we'll have to make consequential amendments. There were other, I think the primary concern was you understood that we had an issue with actually getting all of these organs of state together in one room and to get them to actually function as a committee. But if we do not have any structure, the concern raised by the committee was that they would not be held to account.
All right, so from your answer, I assume you don't have an answer yet.
Well, our answer, Chair, was that we would go with
your
suggestion.
You haven't gone to look at it yet, and you still have to speak to the DG and work through it.
No, we've agreed that we need it in, Chair.
Yeah, but you haven't done it yet and looked at it, so. Because we said you guys can go and look and see whether it needs to be as cumbersome as it is. So can you still look, do that? As a, when we get the comments under one, to be part of that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's chapter 5. Then chapter 6. Let's see what comments there were about chapter 6. Remember, we're working on this document of the first pack. And there are amendments. There are a table of contents in the front that we were working from. We reached page number 31, we've done. Page 17, we've done. Page 35, we've done. What chapter is here? Chapter 6 is on 44.
Chair, page 34 is where we stopped, because it was just before the National Cultural Committee, and our proposal was that at the moment the National Cultural Committee does have all the correct departments on there. So if we're going to keep it, we might as well keep it as is. So we didn't make any proposed amendments to it, but if you see the table, we said agree to the retention of the committee when it comes to all the comments by South African Association, KZN, Western Cape.
No, I want you to go and relook chapter 5.
All right.
And see if there's the principle accepted, but see if there's a better way of doing it. And so let's not look at those comments now, because it's not worth anything.
Okay, Chair.
Until I've given you a chance, because your previous position is gone. Now you haven't had a chance to relook it, so there's not a proper discussion we can have.
Okay. Chairperson Page, then our next point would be page 35. It would be the amendment to section 59, that is the protection and access notices.
I think they have different pages.
That's the old document.
It's a new document.
The heading to that section, that item would be clause 25, amendment to section 59, protection and access notices.
So I must now throw away the previous document, which is part of a bundle, and I must now work on this document.
This is the working document that we started with, Chair. That's why it was submitted separately, because it's a continuation of what we were doing last time.
What is the stuff before this now? Page 34 and other stuff, what is there?
Yeah, that would be the National Coastal Committee stuff. So immediately after that is the section 59.
Yeah, but is this old stuff or new stuff?
No, it's old stuff. It's the old stuff that we haven't gotten to yet.
And if we follow the original document, what's the problem with that?
The original document is on my version, page 35. It's right at the bottom of the page.
Okay. me is, you see, if we're going to get a lot of new documents like this, we're going to really struggle to understand what's going on. 35. So we can go on in the old document. It'll be the same as the new one. You've just given us a copy if we don't have it.
For now, this new one only deals with the stuff we had to come back with. This is the old document, page 35, because we're continuing where we left off.
Yeah. So I'm asking, why can't we just continue where we were last time, or have you amended page 35 and onwards since the last meeting?
No, we haven't.
No, but then we can just continue it. And then need a new document. All right. So it's the old document you're working on, plus the Act. Those are the two documents you need in front of you. And the next amendment is Clause 25 to Clause 15, Section 59. Coastal protection notice. So what is it? Western Cape Provincial Government says what?
Chair, they pointed out that we'd mentioned MEC in subsection 1 but forgot to do so in subsection 2. And we agreed with that amendment. It says that one says the MEC, the minister or MEC, because both are given the power to issue these notices, has reason to believe, etc. And then if you look at 59, subsection 2, before exercising a power to issue a coastal protection notice under subsection 1, the minister, it should read, or MEC. So we've agreed that that needs to be effected, that change. The next comment by Dr. Whittington was just questioning legal drafting. She's asking for renumbering of sections if we change section numbers, but of course according to drafting rules, one as in capital A, you don't change the numbering, so I've just, we've responded to that accordingly.
Yeah, the Act itself, we've also got another amendment there.
Yes,
sir. That one that you brought about already.
Has either prior to or after. That was as a result of the initial public comment. It was pointed out that it actually only talked to activities that were forward looking, and it doesn't deal with old derelict buildings and illegal structures that were there prior to the commencement of the Act.
But is this an amendment you've made, or is it one that you've now brought about? Because
no,
it's not in the comments.
No, Chair, this was the one that we made when the bill was first published for comment, not as a result of the parliamentary comment.
Okay. That's what I want to know. Okay, and then next one.
The next comment.
And then you've also removed the clause there, subclause 3.
Yes, that was an error. The delegations are dealt with further down. And this was also pointed out in the it's actually a superfluous clause because there's already a section dealing with delegations. It was not necessary. And if you look at the wording, there was also an error in the original text, which we dealt with at the same time. That was also as a result of the initial public comments that came through, Chair.
Right, so there's only the one amendment, the MHC one.
Yes.
All right, so that was clause 25, was it? Clause 25. Clause 26. comment on that?
No, that was also, if you look, there was a gross typographical error that came through in the Act during the printing processes, which we alluded to in our very first briefing, but it's also a similar issue of the delegations being dealt with elsewhere.
Can I ask us just to wait a bit, ma'am, if you take a seat first? Good morning, you're now a Member of Parliament. We'll just give everyone a chance to sit down. If you want to take a seat, there's seats anyway, yeah, don't, you can sit anyway, it doesn't matter. Sit on the side here, folks. Sit here, anyway. I'm sure Her Excellency is busy. She doesn't want to wait long for everyone to sit down. Is everyone seated? We have the honor of recognizing the presence in this chamber today Her Excellency Dr. Veronica Nathaniel Makamu-Dlovo, the President of the Assembly of the Republic of Mozambique and her delegation, who's paying an official visit to Parliament at the invitation of the Speaker of the National Assembly. Good morning, ma'am, to you and your delegation. Mm-hmm. Very nice to have you with us. You are this morning with the Portfolio Committee on Environment and Water. You can realize that's a very important committee, one that deals with issues that are very much affecting both our countries. And we're at the moment processing 7 pieces of legislation which we have to have finished before next year when this Parliament rises. So you can imagine the committee's been hectically busy. So that's what we're doing. This is an interesting chamber you're in. The old apartheid Parliament, this was the white chamber where the white folks lorded over the rest of us. And this seat here, it's a very interesting one. I don't know if you remember Dr. Verwoerd, the one that had a lot to do with apartheid. He was stabbed right over there. So you're sitting on the right seat today. You're far away from that seat. So this is called the Old Assembly Chamber. It's got a very rich history. A lot of our discussions around our constitution today, that the Constitutional Assembly Committee used to meet here, and the final constitution, of course, was adopted in the main chamber. But a lot of the work was done in this chamber. We spent many, many hours. I remember I used to sleep somewhere over there on these seats. So that's just a bit of a history of this chamber. You can see it's one of the older ones. This is today also the chamber that the majority party, the African National Congress, uses for its caucus meetings every Thursday. So we do it here with the late Dr. Verwoerd watching over us and possibly turning in his grave every time the ANC makes a decision. So I don't know if you want to, if there's anything you would want to ask the committee. We have all the members of the committee. We have members from the ANC, the opposition, the DA, and COPE here today. I don't know if there's anything you would want to say or address us, but you're free to do so if you would want to, ma'am. Thank you very much. And you can, of course, leave at any stage if you want to. Please don't worry. You don't have to ask us. It will be fine.
Thank you for your explanation. I prefer speaking Portuguese because my English is very poor. My friend helped us. Gostaria de dizer que é com um prazer que estamos a visitar o vosso país. É interessante encontrar-vos a falar de um tema tão importante como a água. Nos nossos países é de facto um recurso muito importante. Portanto, gostava da explicação que deu. Não sei se algum colega terá alguma pergunta a fazer, mas ficamos felizes de saber que despendem horas e horas debater questões específicas, como essa de água, como outras questões, também de grande sensibilidade. Parabéns pelo trabalho, nós estamos aqui para não só aprender, mas também trocar experiências, e trocar experiências naquilo que consubstancia as boas práticas com vista a elevarmos a nossa qualidade de trabalho em prol dos nossos povos. Muito obrigado por toda a explicação mais uma vez e muita força no trabalho, porque dessa força, dessa energia, dessa dedicação, ganhará o povo moçambicano, que é o nosso povo irmão. Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much indeed. Actually, we have visited, we are very glad to be here in this chamber and to meet you while discussing a very important issue that is of common interest. Discussing a very very common interest of water and environment. As you know, this is a common interest for Mozambique and South Africa. And I don't know whether my colleagues have got a question to raise, but if they do not, it's fine. Our presence here actually, it aims to boost the relations between our two parliaments through the sharing of experiences. We believe that the share of good practices will bring not only benefits for Mozambique, but also for South Africa as well. We are glad to know that in this room, you spend more time discussing, and some of you, they sleep here discussing very important issues, and we believe that that is a very good thing when we discuss issues for the benefit of our people. And I would like to thank you once again from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
I apologize for that microphone. It's called the Peters principle. When anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. You went to sit at the wrong microphone. Thank you very much, ma'am. We appreciate it. And obviously, if your committees that deal with environment and with water have any interest to link up with us, we're happy to do it. I'm sure that the protocol staff of Parliament, if you want us to contact anyone there and create that link, we'd be very happy to do so. I'm sure we can learn from them, and maybe there's one or two things they can learn from us, but we definitely will be able to learn from them. I also know there are a lot of important mutual issues, for example, the issues of rhinos. I know we mutually are discussing those. Those are important ones. So there's a lot of things we can link with as committees. So if there's anything you want us to do, please feel free. We are ready to do your bidding, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nothing
bad. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Enjoy the rest of your trip, and don't work too hard. Enjoy the Cape Town a bit. It's a beautiful city. Thank you, ma'am.
Just
deal with the amendments. Don't worry about the others.
Okay. Chair, we did disagree with them because the reason we took it out was because cumulative effects are dealt with in the EIA, under the EIA criteria. These are simply additional criteria for when it comes to the coastal zone. It seems to have caused a lot of emotional response because it looks as if we are removing cumulative impacts when in fact we're not. We're just streamlining the legislation. If you look at also the use within these criteria, we talk about adverse effect, which also includes cumulative impact. So they're not, the fact that it's being visibly taken out doesn't mean that it's not considered. In the EIA process, which is done under NEMA, Redwood Section 63, there is a requirement to look at cumulative impact or cumulative effect.
But if it is something that exists, why are we taking it out? Wouldn't it have more value and stature and status if it's actually in the Act and not part of your internal process?
No, it's part of NEMA. And the EIAs are done in terms of NEMA. What this section purports to do is not repeat the EIA process. It merely adds criteria when they are doing EIAs, which are done in terms of NEMA, but within the coastal zone.
Okay. Next one you agree with. It's just a technical amendment.
Yes. Sure.
Okay, then Whittington is the same. Search is the same.
All the rest are the same.
The same. They all don't want it to leave it. All right, then section 64. There weren't any amendments.
And then the 65, you'll see there's a lot of textual amendments. The first one was the missing out of the word awarding in the heading.
That you agree with? You change it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The second one, they want us to say subject to section 66 under 65.3. Subject to 66A, a coastal use permit may be awarded by the minister, and we disagree because we don't think that it's going to add anything to it. It's really one of those preferences. If the committee likes it, we wouldn't have objection to it.
Coastal use permit may be awarded for this year, subject as the right. This 65 is a coastal use permit in terms of 1A2 may be awarded by Minister either. Then at 65, yeah, now.
Deal with 66. it's obvious that when you the context obviously indicates that when you're dealing with coastal use permits, these provisions will apply.
Why don't you under A2, why don't you say they require a coastal use permit from the minister in terms of subsection or section 66?
Well, yeah, we could do that, Chair. That would work.
In the rest of it, you don't have to duplicate it, because it would be wrong to do it at the bottom of the clause, not at the top. I think that just makes it clearer.
Okay.
I can see why they're confused.
Okay, that's fine,
Chair. Okay? So we'll just put the required coastal that are in terms of section 66. And that's not needed here. Actually, it's a horrible way to draft subject 2. Rather make it. See, and 2 then relates, 3 relates back to 2. If you've got 66 there, it'll be fine. Okay?
Yes.
Everyone happy? That looks better. 66, any amendments?
66, they wanted, you may recall we had some discussion about this during the last session.
Hang on here. Ask for comments here on 65. Okay, so that's there. Unbold the following text.
That was a textual error. Agree.
It must therefore read a ward agree. The ocean coast of EIA branch of NAN, the coastal problem needs to resolve this impasse between also required changes in the EIA. You're saying this has to be addressed elsewhere?
Yes.
Okay. Then section 66.
So
I'm not in agreement with deleting the reference to the maximum time period.
The 20 years thing, and we agreed that we should reinsert it. Because we want to avoid those perpetual leases that go on for 90, well, similar to leases, perpetual coastal use permits.
Yeah, no, I hate those. There's 99 years.
Yes.
See, they were fined under apartheid. Because under apartheid, you didn't have rights for black people. But now you don't need that kind of mechanism anymore. I mean, now all people should be treated equally. You should be able to get a permit. And it should have a reasonable period of time, especially if you want to create a business. But I think it's difficult to make it more than 20 years.
Yeah.
Everyone happy with that? It just seems that at least every 20 years people should apply again. It's like one generation every time. Okay, they agree with that? Everyone agrees?
Yes.
Move the letter yet in the... Okay, agree. So you agree with all that, the 20 years coming back. Okay.
The next comment that came was on section 71.
So there's nothing on 67. Any comments on 67?
No comments on 67.
68. Comments. 69.
Nothing.
Hey, that's discharge of effluent. That's what we must check. Because there's just poo everywhere. So any poo into the water, you must have a discharge authorization. Is that right?
That's correct.
You can't do it otherwise. Do we check this?
Do we check the discharges? Yes.
Okay, so you don't. Thank you, Dee. It's a nice, honest, roundabout answer. I told you there's poo everywhere. But there's no enforcement. 70?
There were no comments on 70.
And then you say 71 there's a comment.
71, there was... this is one of the issues that was raised by Transnet,
where they wanted the time period, 71.5 in particular, you'll see there was at the moment there is a 2-year limitation on a permit with the right to renew it for a further period of more than 2 years, after which they need to make a new application. There are processes that need to be reviewed and so forth, which is why there's only one renewal that's allowed. And that initial time period was a very conservative one. We've spoken to the experts, and Chair, you can consult with the experts who's also here today, on whether we could accommodate a higher period, and they were okay with a period of 5 years.
Who's the expert?
Dr. Peterson.
Speak, expert, or ever hold your peace.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to the committee. Yes, Transnet have proposed or requested that we make the validity period of the, specifically from their perspective, the dredging permits in ports, to make them valid for a period for up to 5 years. And our understanding is really that it's intended to be focused on activities that are fairly routine, year-to-year dredging activities that don't involve too much of dredge material proposed for sea disposal. So I think at this point we have no...
What is it at the moment?
At the moment it's 1-year permits.
Oh.
It's annual dredging permits, and there's an element of certainty because, as I've said, there are a lot of routine dredging operations in the ports. And I think from Transnet's perspective, the question really is, can we not do away with some of the administrative burden involved in having to reapply for fairly the same permits each year? There is an element of certainty. We know more than how much of dredge material is being proposed for sea disposal. So I think the main issue is really, can we do away with some of the administrative burden?
Let's look at the last part of the clause, where after a new application. Now, as an expert, how often do you think the new application needs to be made? I think we must start there.
Okay, we've given it some thought, and from the information and literature that we've consulted, when it comes to specifically dredging, we tend to have a good understanding of how the quality of the material varies over, let's say, a 3-year period. excuse me. So I think 5 years gives us a sufficient time to be able to say we have a good understanding of the quality of the port sediment over that period to then say, well, you now need to undergo a full assessment for a new application. And based
so you,
on
you would like new application every 5 years?
Well, as the text now stands, it says we can issue for a period of up to 5 years. We also have to bear in mind that...
Yeah, but then you've got a renewal of another 2. That's why I'm asking the question. Because surely those 2 must be read together, and we mustn't exceed whatever time we want to exceed. If we say 5 years, we either must say no longer than 5 years and take away the renewal, or we must say 3 years and keep the 2 years renewal. But that creates more paperwork. So, I mean, if you're saying to me as an expert that around 3 to 5 years you want to kind of make sure that this, what is being done is the same type of thing, I can understand that, but then it seems to me we must make a... Yeah, either we must then say for not more than 5 years, which is fine, it can then be 1 year if the minister so decides, but then we must take out the renewal, mustn't we? Because then it otherwise gets to 7 years. Or we do 3 years and 2 years renewal, but that just seems like extra admin. Telling me that every 5 years is kind of okay. So what are we thinking, DG? Expert? Dr. Peterson?
Yeah. I think that we do not have the other 2 years for renewal. It should be more...
We then take away the renewal, just say not more than 5 years. And then minister has discretion if it's... you know, kind of material that she knows, and in that license, surely you could say, subject to only using this material. You can surely say that in the license. And if you want to change this material, then you must come back to us. That can all be done in the license.
So are members okay with that? So we make it a 5 years, but we take away the renewal thing. Otherwise, it takes it to 7 years. Okay. Everyone happy? All right.
Chair, the next set of comments came in section, with regard to section 92, which is...
92. Well, let me just see what's before 92. That was... So there's nothing on 72, 73, 74, there's no amendments. In 74 there was an amendment, but there's no comment. So there's no amendments there. In 79 there are a lot of amendments. And we've got an amendment, we've agreed to that. 79. Left that out.
We don't have comments on that, Chair.
Got it in green here.
In 79.
Error. Comma should be a semicolon.
That's an error that we picked up when we were revising.
Okay, technical. But you must bring it to our attention.
Yes.
How can we approve it if we don't know it? Department's proposal. There. What is this prevent?
We dealt with this during the last session. I just want to refresh your memory, Chair. It was when we were dealing with the access to coastal public property. One of the shortcomings we picked up in the Act is that we actually don't have an offence for the prevention of access. So if somebody stops somebody from having access to the coast, we hadn't created an offence for it. We created a whole lot of administrative procedures to remove barriers and that kind of thing, but we didn't have an offence, and this was a proposal.
So you've now put this in since then, okay.
Yes. Okay.
All right, so we agree with that? It's an amendment that flows from... We would have done it when we get to the new amendments, but we've done it now. 80, there's a whole lot of amendments here without... $5 million, $2 million. What kind of problem is it? 6 and 71, 9, 7, 1. Discharge effluent. Yeah. The poo dumpers. $5 million penalty, lovely. And incinerates, loads, dumps, alters. Yes, man. You know, some of this could be very poisonous substance. Eh? I wonder who would eliminate that. I think as a general principle this is fine, but what happens if someone dumps the most poisonous substance you can think of in the water, and we're saying that at best you can be 5 minutes. I mean, let's say someone goes and dumps uranium. I mean, you know.
Chair, are you suggesting that we should up the fine? Because I'm
no, I think you can't, because I mean, obviously it's a general, but maybe what we can do is, you see, it all depends on the court's jurisdiction. So maybe what we can do is to say that the fine
the imprisonment period is 10 years, and the fine.
I think what we must do is we must create it. You see, the only thing you can do is to
change the place where the prostitution takes place. So the way to get around this is to keep all this, and then to say, notwithstanding all these clauses, that if a person has been charged in and convicted in a high court, then the limits above don't apply. And that will give the prosecuting authority, they get a serious case, then what they do is they charge in the high court, get a conviction in the high court, then the sentences don't apply, they can give any sentences. I think we just to not get stuck with letting someone do something very serious and then we limit them only to a 10-year sentence. Okay, so we'll do that. Create a clause like that, okay? Unlimited clause. And as I said, the only way to do it is to link it to the court where the matter is brought. Because you don't want to limit your high court in any case in terms of sentences and so on. Alright. Okay, so that is sentencing. That is 18. That still doesn't bring us to 96. Then 81, there's all the amendments. There's nothing. 83, there's amendments, no comment. Oh no, the department's got something here.
There's an error that was picked up.
Delete the word bid.
There's no bid process for authorization. This was part of a very old draft, and it was erroneously left in the act.
Okay, so removing that, and then above, omit the word and.
Textual error.
What will be there if it's not and? Or?
The word and is omitted.
Yeah.
So we need to put it there.
Oh, you, it was omitted, so you're putting it in?
Putting it in.
Oh, okay. Alright, no, that's fine. Okay. Isn't it an or? These are all considerations. If you put and, it means all of those considerations must be considered. Is that what you're intending? The procedure to be followed with the logic and consideration of applications for coastal authorization, including the conditions on which the applicant must comply, the application fees, the authorities, the consultations, that. It's probably safe that you may have it as an or.
It's
including all that.
Regulations.
I think it's probably more appropriate just to save it. Okay. And then the bid is gone, because that's an old. That's 83, 84, there's no comment. 85, 86, no comment. 87, there's no amendments. 88, no amendments. 89, amendments but no comments. 90, comment, amendments, no comments. 91, there's green. Error, did not delete full stop and replace with a semicolon. Okay, that's fine, we'll do that. Then 92, here's an amendment, it's not 96. No, 92, yeah, here it is. That's the next amendment, 92.
Yes, Chair, this is where... A stay.
So Dr. Whittington said, replace stay with stop.
Yes, it wasn't Dr. Whittington, it was the person from KZN. I think that was, I'm not from KZN, from the Survey General, the Office of Women's Health and all that, but Dr. Whittington might have. They want us to replace the word stay with stop and activity. This could be a linguistic thing, but in my mind the word
do
stay.
I say stay, where is it?
If you look at 92.1, the minister or MEC may issue a verbal directive to any responsible person. Stay an activity if such activity poses risk, etc.
Oh, no, in fact, I like immediate stop.
Okay. I have
no,
a sense.
Stay is a legal term.
Yes.
Stay is a legal term. Okay. I think we shouldn't put it in here. Stay is when you have a court application and then something can't continue, then you stay the proceedings or you stay the thing, which has the same meaning. No, yeah, you want to issue a verbal directive to any responsible person to immediately stop an activity, such an activity. Pose an immediate risk, an immediate risk.
Okay, I had a sense you would say that. I'm not hectically opposed to it. I just thought that stay was more appropriate because it doesn't mean that that activity wouldn't be allowed to continue. If
no, but stay is a legal terminology. It has a particular meaning to it.
Perhaps
to put it in here where it's something that a minister is doing is just inappropriate.
Okay.
I think they must immediately stop an activity if such activity poses the following threats.
Okay.
So I think we agree. We yeah agree with whoever said it and not with the department. We're going to stay your decision.
I respectfully concur.
Then a grammatical error, which you agree to in section. Okay, wait, let's first see 93, section 93. There were amendments. There's the department's proposal there. 93. You don't have it as an amendment.
This here was regarding... because a lot of this came out of the changes to the National Coastal Committee. And there was certain reporting that was intended to happen there. But when we're reviewing the section, when it came to the status of pipelines, it was one of the things that had to be essentially check the ship or information and reporting in coastal matters. The minister must prepare and regularly update a national report on the state of coastal environment, which must include. We had here the status of each pipeline that discharges effluents previously, and we thought it would be better if the report created the obligation to report on progress in all the national responsibilities rather than just focusing on pipelines, and that is what came out of the public comments, that to talk only to the discharge is diminishing.
This thing is close to my heart. Discharge, effluent,
okay.
And pool in the sea. So I think you must keep it progress on all national responsibilities in the Act. Then you say including, and then you put the review. So you do broaden it, but don't miss out on the pool.
Okay, no, it's true.
94. There's nothing here, but you've got it in here. What is that? What is 94? Space must be added between such an exemption.
Technical amendment.
That's fine. 95. Eastern Cape withdrew the comment after clarification of the portfolio. Number 50 for section 59, the actual role of the MSC must be carried out.
There's cross references and technical amendments to this, corrections of the text. department.
But you're saying that we withdrew the comment, or you withdrew the comment?
Chair, it was about, it was Sandiso's delay. Mr. Zide, I recall him raising the issue of not understanding why. It was the whole issue of the leases and the interim arrangements, and where we explained that we were getting them all in to see what's happening. But then some of them would continue and others not. And they would then be regulated.
This has got to do with MSCs and
leases.
And local government. Not leases.
This is about leases.
The municipality to coordinate actions taken in terms of this act by provincial organs and monitor compliance by such municipalities. It's not leases.
Chair, if you read further on, 94, I'm looking at 95. Sorry, I'm looking at 95.
I'm at 94.
Chair, I don't have any comments for 94.
We've
got comments on 94A, which is exemption,
uh-huh.
And that's the textual amendment.
Oh, is that the textual?
Yes, saying okay. The space must be added between such an exemption.
So the other comment is 95.
It's 95. It's on the existing. It's on the existing leases. And this was also, we had a lot of discussion during the public comment phase. And you looked at those clauses to try and understand what we were trying to do. Essentially, what this clause is doing is allowing a system of everybody sending every lease that they currently have, so that we can do an inventory of leases at the moment. And then some of those may be listed for coastal use permits, either prohibitions or activities that require coastal use permits. The provinces were saying that you give it, that at the moment, provinces are administering leases under the Seashore Act, and that is correct. What we're trying to do is we are trying to replace that system because it was inconsistently applied and it wasn't very well managed across the provinces. So we want to replace that entire system with the system of coastal use permits. The Eastern Cape was trying to understand, are we interfering with their leases? And in a sense, what we're doing is we're creating a centralized way of dealing with them.
But don't they, I mean, I agree with what you're doing, but don't, I mean, they may have not articulated the problem correctly, but, I mean, isn't there a process that then needed once the copy's been given?
Chair, what we said...
Because, I mean, you know, I'm asking the question, yeah. And this is what I think they're thinking, is how will they know what's happening up there when they're not aware of it down here?
Chair, what this is trying to say, may not be saying effectively, is we get the copies in, then we publish the list. So they have a period within which everything continues up until that period. We then have to publish the minister's list.
Where does it say that?
That comes in, that doesn't come in here, this is red with 66.
66.
So the 66 is the coastal use permit, because it says, okay, if we go through...
But where does it say that there's going to be a list from the minister?
Subsection 1, subject to PI, etc. You look at the yellow part, 96.1, okay, I'm looking at 96, sorry. If you look at 95, in order to enable the minister to establish, etc., within 12 months of the commencement of the section, provide the minister with a copy of the lease. A lease under the Seashore Act, which now talks to the existing leases, shall continue for a period of 24 months after the commencement of the section and section 98, unless the term of the lease provides, the terms of the lease provides for it to lapse earlier, or the lease relates to an activity that is listed in terms of section 65, as prohibited or requiring a permit. That's the link that's made to the coastal use permit.
If it doesn't fall under any of those
legal access. In terms of the lease provides legal access, it says that in 2A. And perhaps we need to clarify that in the wording of it.
You see, A and B, I mean, why it seems a little bit ambiguous, because A and B, it actually means that the lease lapses immediately in one of those things. So you have to say the lease, the terms of the lease provides for it to lapse earlier, or the lease relates an activity that is listed. I mean, you'll have to link something to B to make it happen. Because just to say if it falls in that activity, who decide that that lease falls in that activity? How do they say it? How would the person ever know that their activity actually falls within B?
Chair, that's what the list is intended to convey. So if it's listed, it means that the minister would have published that list by that time. But I agree,
but
we need to clarify it.
But where is the issue of the list then stated?
In 65.1a, which is cross-referenced.
65.1a. 65.1a. The minister may write notice in the Gazette, list activities that are prohibited require a coastal use permit. Yeah, but that just tells you the activities. Still doesn't tell you whether their lease falls within one of those activities.
I get your point, Chair, and I think we need to work.
I mean, I like this idea that the minister is going to present a notice and then you react on that, rather than that someone must just work out for themselves whether their activities falls under A or B, and then suddenly the lease just falls away. I mean, I think something more must be said in B. The release relates to an activity that's listed in da-da-da. Well, it can't be listed there because, again, it could create uncertainty. I mean, you could put a lot of categories in 65, and that person still doesn't know where their lease falls within that category. So I think you need to do something that creates certainty here around... Look, I don't think there should be too much uncertainty about A.
Yeah, you make a good point, Chair, because we're presuming that the way that lease is couched, we would be able to list that activity, and it may not be the case.
Because now you're going to list use permits, but it may not relate, the person may not have the capacity to work out that their lease work is actually falling in that category.
Yes, Chair, I think we need to think a bit more about... making it clearer.
And they must be informed then by note. They must then be informed that said your lease is lapses immediately because it's contrary to clause so and so. Because in terms of this act, it will mean all other leases that haven't lapsed will then lapse after 2 years.
Yes.
So that creates certainty. Your lease lapses after 2 years, or your lease lapses on the date that it lapses before the 2 years. Or your lease lapses when we tell you it falls within a use permit activity and therefore it lapses.
Okay.
So you have to create a process there.
Yeah. Okay.
Create procedure to end lease. Okay. Everyone happy with that? I've seen that makes it clearly. Unless a person A is directed, otherwise the person A... not an offence for that person to continue if that person makes an application for a permit under that within 24 months but has not yet been done for that application for a clause. Okay, so that is a saving clause. Alright, that was 95.
Chair was just further clarifying the cross-reference, the textual amendment.
Insert unlawfully built on coastal public bus must in 12 months notify the rent authority of an island. What are you saying? Why do you disagree?
Chair, we thought that we were giving them an opportunity to rectify. And if we tell them to tell us that they're doing something unlawful, they're unlikely to do it. So we didn't think that it would add anything to it. It might just force people to go underground.
What page is this comment on?
It is on page 41.
Insert unlawfully built on coastal public property. Subject to the provision of illegal eviction in subsection. Why do you make it subject to the prevention of illegal eviction?
That was on the advice of the federal advisors. Because if there are, they thought it was a constitutional issue that one had to follow those procedures of eviction if you're dealing with impoverished families that were occupying something illegally. You couldn't just go through the normal process. You had to go through the prior process.
What does that process entail?
Sure, it's a lot more cumbersome than a normal eviction. There has to be, I can bring the section to you if you want to read it.
No, explain to me.
Your
department is now saying that this is going to apply.
Yes, this has always been applied, Chair. This has been from the inception of the Act. In fact, we didn't have it in initially, and we were advised by the federal advisor that it would not be certified if it was not inserted, simply because it raises a constitutional issue. The prevention, the PI Act, for want of a better term, gives impoverished households, households headed by single mothers who are in unlawful occupation, it makes it more difficult to evict them. There are certain obligations to bring...
But now, to protect poor people, now we know who actually stays unlawfully is all the rich people.
Not always, Chair. There are certain...
But you're now protecting the rich people. Forget the poor people for a minute.
But they wouldn't be covered by PIE because it doesn't...
If anyone has unlawfully constructed a building or structure on coastal public property, then you must go through these processes. You're now giving them further protection.
Chair, it is subject to PIE. PIE does not apply. So obviously, if it's a subject to PIE, it would be subject
what
to...
What do you mean it doesn't apply?
It doesn't apply to tenancy. It applies only to a specific class of tenants that don't have leases, that aren't in local tenancy, but that are impoverished. PIE, as far as the legal situation was, does not apply to rich tenants. So it would then, in other words, if you're on coastal public property, if PIE applies, in other words, if the tenants that are there are subject to PIE, then only you would have to follow the PIE processes. But if it's normal tenancy or if it's normal unlawful, if they don't fulfill the criteria in 5, then 5 wouldn't apply.
Okay, bring that act to us and come and show us. Don't just give it to us. Come and show us how this won't apply to the rich people. Okay, so that was the comment from now what part of their comment do you find unrealistic, because you've got the word unlawfully there as well?
No, it's not the unlawful part. They want them. Okay, I put a caveat there. May or may not be unreasonable. What they're asking for is the notification of the relevant. They say at the moment the wording reads subject to all of this stuff, any unlawfully, a structure unlawfully built on CPP must within 12 months of the commencement of this act either apply for a coastal lease, a coastal use permit if the activity is listed, or demolish the building and structure as far as reasonably possible and restore it to its condition before the building or other structure was built. They're proposing that we add the word after 12 months after the commencement of this act, notify the relevant authorities thereof, and then either do one of the two. We feel that if you ask them to do this notification, there's going to be a knee-jerk reaction by people about them admitting to unlawful activities, when in fact what the act is simply saying is either you're going to then apply to us for a permit or you're going to demolish it. And we then take care of that via our Section 60 notices. We can demolish if they don't, and then they are ordered to do rehabilitation. What the province is saying is they want us to strengthen this clause. They want us to say that in addition to doing those things, they must first notify us. That's the first recommendation they make.
No, but the notifying surely reflects on the B, not the A. Because the A, they're going to apply to you in any case. You don't need notification.
Correct.
They're talking about the B.
No, they want it to be put in the A part. They want it to be put in the
chateau. That doesn't make sense in A, but it makes sense in B.
That's where
otherwise B just hangs in the air.
But they actually want to put it on the top, but perhaps you're right. That might be a better place to put it if we do put it in, because they want it in the chateau, which goes before
A.
In
A, it doesn't make sense, because in A you have to apply for a permit. So if you're applying for a permit, whoever is you're applying to knows about it.
Yes.
So you don't need it there. But under the B, it's just hanging in the air.
So we can add
it. You just acknowledge and you don't tell anyone.
Notify
and no one can check whether you've restored it to its proper condition and so on.
Correct. But the point is, Chair, is that only the abiders will do it anyway. Most people are just not going to do anything and wait for us to go around and enforce
it. Do you have the power to take action?
Yes, we do.
Because this ties you down only to them taking action, not you taking action.
No, we can take action in the normal course as well. And when we issue those notices, we ask them to do the rehabilitation and all of that. That's our enforcement powers in 5960.
Shouldn't we say here that anyone that does not do this, comply with this section fully within 12 months, will be responsible for all the costs incurred thereafter?
In terms of the notice, we are allowed to ask them for costs.
But that's the notice.
Yes.
I'm now saying that shouldn't we, in the statute, have an enforcement clause that says that if you've not done it, not complied fully with one in 12 months, then whatever costs are incurred to rectify your unlawful occupancy will then be able to be retrieved from you.
Chair, that is in the text of Section 61. Which says failure to comply with notices, because we would have to, in terms of the rule of law, we'd have to first serve them with these notices so that they have a chance to do what they're asked. And then if they don't, if you look at...
Why would you have to give notice? If an Act of Parliament tells you you must do it in 12 months and you haven't done it, why do you have to give notice?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Give them a time period after which these clauses then apply. But if something...
Then you say that if you've not done this, I mean, how does this thing have to have teeth? What teeth has it got? Look at that thing there. What teeth has it got? Absolutely nothing. It says do it in 12 months and if you don't, there's nothing.
Okay, yeah, I get that. Sorry, Chair.
61, did you say the notice?
61. Failure to comply with notices, we can recover costs from you.
That's only 59 and 60.
Yes. Yeah, but I misunderstood. You're saying that this is a different process. This is giving them a time period, failing which they automatically are...
You can have your own process. If you have a notice thing that's saying we've noticed that you've not done it in the 12 months, then that's fine. But there must be a consequence if you don't follow this. Not done in 12 months, then all costs to restore and you come and explain this other act to us. You say it only applies to poor people.
In fact, I think I should call the state law advisors who forced us to do it in the first place.
Yeah, I don't care who does it, but if you guys can come and explain to us what it is you're trying to achieve. I mean, if it's protection for just poor people, I'm happy. But if it's prepared, if it's going to give a loophole for rich people, then I am totally unhappy. Okay. Ma'am?
Chair.
And all the things that we've done this morning, make sure you've updated all that
yes.
in the other documents so that when we, we'll finish the general comments
yes.
and then we'll start from the beginning
okay.
with the things, okay?
Okay, thank you, Chief.
Are you happy with that?
Yes.
DG?
Sure, I've also been in that quagmire about the aspect of control of pollution, I think, which would be under Chapter 8. The aspect that somewhat overlaps with transport in maritime control. We currently, in respect of oil spills, that is regulated under the SAMHSA Act. We work jointly with them through a delegation, but as a department we do then the combating when we are involved in the combating activities, but my sense is that we are a Department of Environment responsible for the quality of that environment. So here we should be strengthening more the norms and standards, or at least a description of what is the best stage of a cleanup after the oil spillage. So I don't know how we, I mean, the team.
Which part of this act is that dealt with?
Can you talk to each? Chair, we don't directly deal with that, Chair. We deal with some pollution aspects in Section 59, which is the coastal water discharge, and we deal with dumping permits. That's the extent of our pollution. The actual mandate that we've got for the combating was assigned to this department many years ago in one marine notice from the SAMHSA Act. It's actually a Department of Transport mandate that they assigned to this department through some engagement that happened then. What happened subsequently was the department has then become responsible for physically going out there and fighting and cleaning up oil spills that have come off from ships. We don't have any other legislation except what transport has given us, and that's wholly inadequate. They've been managing that function through informal documents between transport and this department on oil, and they have oil spill contingency plans. Dr. Peterson can give you more details on how that unfolds and how they've actually been working. But we don't have a proper legal framework that deals with what we should be doing, and that is actually setting the norms and standards for what kind of...
But why do you need a whole piece of legislation for that, or at least an amendment to this act?
That should be in this act.
Yes, no, but I'm saying that shouldn't be a whole thought-out amendment. The problem is to try and introduce it now will be difficult. It's too a bigger thing to pass without going through cabinet. I mean, in principle, I don't think we will disagree. But the problem is, I mean, there should be a process by which this takes place. It's too big. If it was just a small technical amendment we can make here, that's one thing. But to write a whole chapter on... What you can do for me is do a resolution. You know the way I do a resolution. And spell out in the resolution what the problem is, and then the recommendation of the committee to the resolution is that the department needs to urgently prepare amendments to this legislation or new legislation to deal with this thing. You guys got me?
Yes, Chair, I'll take a note of that.
Write on the front of your bill so you don't forget. Draft resolution oil spill lack of legal framework. So what we can do is then you draft such a say this is the problem, and the committee then recommends that amendments are either drafted or a new legislation is brought to actually fully deal with this aspect as soon as possible. And that will give you the thing that we can follow up on.
Okay.
Okay.
Chair, I'm sorry to do this at this stage. There's one other issue that occurred to me that may become an issue for the committee to consider, is we are busy engaging with national parks on the power to excise parks from the coastal protection zone, but we aren't yet in a position to inform the committee as to a direction and whether we would need to make minor amendments to the text to address some of their problems. And their problems specifically relate to the powers that MECs would then have over national parks as opposed to just having power over provincial parks. We are meeting with them and we're busy deliberating. We may, with your permission, come back with some of those issues.
If there are small technical amendments, this committee will always accommodate it. If there are substantial, then we won't accommodate it, because clearly there's a process we have to then go through.
Thank you, Chair.
NB, maybe technical amendments, reed parks and protected areas, or coastal areas, reed parks and coastal areas. Is that the problem? Huh? Have I stated correctly? Reed parks and coastal areas. Okay. All right, now there's a lot of work to be done and we need to start tightening up. We've now as a committee been able to go through all the comments except the general comments. So by next time we can then start looking now at the amendments that we've agreed to and that you've drafted. So I'm trying to think how we will. I think we must keep them in the act. I find them much more useful in the act as they are now. I suppose all that you can do is, keep it as it is now in the yellow. And where we've agreed to something, I think you put it in green, but that we've already, so I think what you must do is just do it in another color, say red. So all the green ones we've agreed to, plus the new ones you've changed, is then in one color? I'll do it in gray, it's fine. I don't care what color we do it, but try and keep the yellow as it is, and then as you, whatever amendments, you've got one other color. So the next time we look at the bill, we can see the new color is everything that you have done, responded to what we've done. And then what is uncertain and you're not really sure about yet, you know, make that a third color if you have to, whatever, okay? Everyone happy with that? Now, I've just been told about a very happy event that Mr. Rogers is having, who's now under the table already, who's having his birthday today. It's his 21st, apparently. A very big happy birthday, Mr. Rogers. I hope you'll have many more, and I hope you and your family are able to celebrate, and I hope you get spoiled like mad by your family and your party. I include your party because you're down here with them and they are in your family. Of course, this committee, nothing stops you from giving him a biscuit. On behalf of the committee. There we are. That's the committee's present to you. It's a biscuit from the committee. But a big happy birthday and many happy returns. All right, so we'll meet tomorrow when we'll have the joint sitting with minerals and with water, okay? Again, yeah? Good Hope Chamber, okay? Good Hope Chamber, I tried to get this. I told them to speak to their managers, but their managers don't listen in this case. Okay, Good Hope Chamber tomorrow at 9 sharp. We'll start with the joint hearing, okay?